with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 20th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kira Kiefer, visiting assistant professor of religious studies at Wesleyan University and author of Unvaccinated Under God, Religion and Vaccine Hesitancy in Modern America. Also on the program, at least three U.S. service members were killed over the weekend in Trump's criminal war on Iran after the U.S. resumed bombing Iran and its civilian infrastructure. The Pentagon has also reportedly been hiding the extent of military injuries and equipment damage.
What?
Huh.
They wouldn't do that.
Iran finally plays their Houthi card. Yemen's Houthis declare a naval blockade of Saudi Arabia, a closure of another key trade checkpoint outside of the Strait of Hormuz. Gas has once again topped $4 a gallon. In the UK, Andy Burnham officially succeeds Keir Starmer as British PM, taking over an anemic Labour government. The FBI tells its agents via written notice that the feds are just, you know, not going to investigate violent ICE encounters going forward. We don't want to.
ICE will investigate themselves.
The administration is also quietly shutting down multiple corporate criminal investigations with zero charges. In Maine, Troy Jackson has been selected as the replacement Democratic Senate nominee, a win for the left in the state. With 4 days to go until recess, Republicans are pessimistic about their agenda of Planned Parenthood cuts, voter disenfranchisement, and Iran war funds via reconciliation. Manosphere chuds and predators Andrew and Tristan Tate were arrested Saturday after British authorities filed new charges against them, rape and sex trafficking. That's so out of character.
Or it's their brand proposition.
Yeah.
Great video of that.
Oh my God. Why was he wearing a caftan?
Guys in the most ludicrous outfit coming to take your chains off as you have handcuffs on.
And no-show socks, which big hallmark of a guy like that. Trump's Qatari donated jet is being sent out for repairs after his administration subpoenaed New York Times journalists for reporting on how sketchy it was.
They're going to max it out. It's not quite maxed out yet.
And lastly, Israeli strikes in Gaza City on Saturday killed at least 9, including 3 children. The genocide in Gaza continues. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Look, guys, I am sorry to report that Sam is not here. And, you know, it's going to be a little while. He's continuing to do his Hollywood, you know, jaunt. Mm-hmm. He's filming something. We can't say exactly what it is. We promise you that he's alive and his body isn't in the trunk of Brian's car. Okay. So,
I spoke to him for 20 minutes this weekend.
And what did you talk about? The war in Iran and the developments in Maine?
Yeah, we talked about the Senate race, a little Senate history.
Gotcha.
The war in Iran, yeah, Michigan, all kinds of stuff.
Then Matt talked to him for 20 minutes. Then I talked to him for 20 minutes. Yeah. And then he was just a little bit too tired, but we'll take on shifts tomorrow.
This is true. He did tell me he went parasailing, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. But
yes.
Okay, John Kerry.
Yeah, I know. Right before a crucial election in Michigan? What are you doing, buddy? I would like to see a photo of him parasailing. I have heard this rumor, and it seems so out of character. I want to see him in the little helmet with the vest.
Probably his glasses still on.
Oh my god.
In a cardigan.
I can't.
Above a lake.
I can't wait to get more photographic evidence of what he's been up to. But he will be back, we promise. In AI form or animatronic form or, you know, in spirit.
Well, he would be back sooner if Kathy Hochul wouldn't put a moratorium on data centers.
Ew.
It's taking us a long time to generate AI sales.
Exactly. The left has gone too far. Over the weekend, Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you may have heard of them, they headed to Michigan to rally with Abdullah Sayed ahead of the August 4th primary. They also rallied with a pair of congressional candidates who should be on your radar if you're a Michigan voter, Will Lawrence and Donovan McKinney. Will Lawrence is running in a primary against Matt Mazdam, I believe. He's an environmental activist. Bernie Sanders has endorsed him. And then you also have Donovan McKinney, who's a state representative, and he is challenging Sri Thandahar, who is one of the most corporate Democrats in Congress. They were a part of these rallies as well. Now, as you're about to hear from both Senator Sanders and AOC, around $50 million has been spent in outside money in this primary. The Zionist lobby in particular is attempting to make an example of Abdullah Sayed for choosing to speak out against Israel's genocide, cutting arms to Israel a central plank of his campaign, and just generally being Muslim and wanting to be in higher office. Ugh. The Zionists don't like that. That of that $50 million or $46 million, if you're looking just at this pot here, or what has been analyzed prior to the increase in spending, the AIPAC cutout United Democracy Project has spent at least $15 million against Al Sayed on Haley Stevens's behalf. Then you also have this separate PAC, A Stronger Michigan, which has spent over $12 million to support Stevens, and that is a dark money pack. It's a dark money group that reporters at Sludge and other outlets have connected to this guy, Jeffries Murray, who is a lobbyist. And his past clients include Meta, Northrop Grumman, the weapons manufacturer, and the American Gas Association. But pointing this out is extremely misogynistic when we're talking about Haley Stevens.
You're trying to tear down another female lawmaker, Emma.
Yeah, because I'm old enough to remember, as Sam will say, you know, there were times when women couldn't have a credit card in their name, and now we're trying to besmirch this woman.
Unbelievable.
For all the spending that she's doing, you know, for her campaign. Are you trying to say women can't spend money or people can't spend money on behalf of women? You want to control women. This is dripping in sarcasm because, honestly, these attacks against Abdullah Sayed are so disgusting, and they're using misogyny and sexism with such cynicism that they make the real claims about misogyny and sexism a lot less salient, and it's immensely important, especially in this time of fascism when we have, you know, the United States military essentially cheerleading testosterone injections and talking about how the war fighters need to just be masculine, and that, you know, we played that clip of Jesse Waters on Fox News being like, the other women in the U.S. Army should watch out for all these testosterone-filled men, as if there hasn't been a systemic problem with rape in the military going unreported. I mean, that they're celebrating it. So to use this, the Democratic Party and these PACs that are associated with the genocidal lobby, to use this so cynically is, you know, another example of liberals throwing anybody from trans people to just women in general under the bus to achieve their ends of maintaining the status quo. And with all of that said, here is Bernie Sanders at that rally with Abdullah Sayed, still going strong, our buddy Bernie, talking about what this election is really about.
In all due respect to Haley Stevens, everybody, no? In all due respect to Congresswoman Stevens, everyone knows that this is not an election between her and Abdul el-Sayed. This is an election between Abdul and the billionaire class. That is what this election is about. A billionaire class which has already, and there are 2 weeks left to go in the election, has already spent $50 million against them. Now, I want everybody here throughout the state, people turning on the TVs and they see all these ads, I want you to ask yourself a simple question. Why are the richest people in the country spending tens and tens of millions of dollars to defeat Abdul el-Sayed? Why does the billionaire class feel that they need to outspend them in this election 12 to 1? 12 to 1! What are they afraid of? And the answer is obvious. They understand, quite correctly, that when Abdul is elected to the Senate, he will work with me and other progressives in taking on the greed of the billionaire class and fight for an economy and a government that works for all of us, not just the 1%.
So there you go, Bernie.
That is what the bill.
Bernie on message once again.
He sounds exactly like he did 20 years ago.
Exactly. And, you know, but here's the, I guess, his protege or the politician who he seems to think most equipped to take up his mantle, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, saying something similar, pointing to the corruption in this race at this rally.
That we have to choose, each and every one of us as individuals. It is something that we have to elect to do. And right now, there is a very clear choice before us. We can choose to reward the $50 million in dark money by voting their way, which, by the way, Michigan, do you think that $50 million is for free? Do you think that $50 million is an act of charity? We know how this works. There's $50 million in this race because they're expecting a return. It's an investment. And how they make back their money is by allowing all of this stuff to continue so that you pay more and more into their pockets. That's what that $50 million is about. So we can choose that, or we can choose Dr. Abdul el-Sayed for the United States Senate.
Exactly right. This is not being dumped into this race because it's an act of charity or because people just like don't have enough room in their mattress for the $50 million being poured into this race. It's an investment in a corrupt political system.
Wait, you don't think the most powerful people that have all this money are doing it because they want to benefit all of us and they just know what's best?
Yeah, I guess that is what I'm saying, Matt, believe it or not. And people intrinsically understand that. Now, what's also fascinating is that this is pissing off the powers that be in the Democratic Party in a way that is kind of humorous, actually, because CNN had this article, and we're going to play a clip of them talking about their reporting, but the article points out how successful Sanders' endorsements have been this cycle, Just this election cycle, Sanders has endorsed more than 90 candidates, helping defeat House incumbents in New York City and Colorado. Of the 60 candidates who have had their elections already, 42 have won their races, including
Steph
10.
Curry numbers.
Yep. And speaking of Steph Curry, in the fun half, we'll probably get to this Wall Street Journal reporting on Israel and its influence campaign and who they've been targeting in the United States. And Steph Curry, unfortunately, is one of them. And his office or his press people declined to comment, didn't deny it. But like Israel and other dark money groups are paying influencers online to astroturf some of these campaigns. And this race has been one of the number one areas where they've attempted this strategy. But yeah, so of the 60 candidates who have had their elections already, 42 have won their races, including 10 out of 16 federal candidates, according to his team. But in Washington, senior Democrats argue that Sanders is forcing them to divert precious cash to primaries instead of spending to fight the GOP in November. So, you know, there's another option for you guys then. Don't spend and meddle in primaries. Let the voters decide and save all of your cash to defeat Republicans. But they're acting like he's right. Making us do this. He's making us because these candidates are so far left that we have to spend against them and use our war chest in primaries. I thought that this was the party that was vote blue no matter who to defeat Republicans because of the fascist threat that they represent. What happened?
The Citizens United happened, and now these people have sold the party to donors who don't want to support what actually needs to be supported in this country.
Yep, and it's the donors, and also in the media, it is riddled with a consultant class that hates this kind of campaigning because it makes them irrelevant. It makes their fat checks that are written to them for all of this infrastructure, their middlemen that are completely unnecessary. And it's why they hate Morris Katz and Fight Agency and what he's been doing, because they do consulting and political organizing in a different way. But the structure of a campaign that doesn't take corporate money is a lot less lucrative to this parasitic infrastructure in the Democratic Party that has led us down this road of fascism. And yet they are represented so disproportionately in our media, including on outlets like CNN. Here they are reporting or talking about how Hakeem Jeffries and Gregory Meeks in particular are upset at Bernie Sanders.
Sanders has backed over 90 candidates, and according to his team, 42 of them have won their races,
all right, damn it.
Including 10 out of 16 federal candidates. Here's a look at some of them on your screen. There's some controversial ones that have caused some significant blowback within the Democratic ranks, including a critical Michigan House race there, Congressman in the Michigan 7th Congressional District, a battleground district. That one is William Lawrence there. That's a big fight that's happening, will happen in that August 4th primary. Hakeem Jeffries had this phone call with Bernie Sanders, and along with Gregory Meeks, a New York Democrat, on it. Meeks said, told us, Sanders seemed not to care after they were raising concerns about meddling in the primaries.
Yeah. I mean, that is Bernie Sanders. I mean, a lot of this, as I was looking at some of the rallies there from Bernie Sanders, you're reminded of 2016, this real force that Bernie Sanders was in his race against Hillary Clinton.
And okay, pause it for a second. You know, first of all, why would Bernie's 84? Why would he care? He
blowback. We talk about Noah Coleman and Brendan James.
Yeah. Also, Bernie's like, I've been trying to play nice this entire time, and now I've got the juice because you've burned your credibility so thoroughly. That's the difference between 2016 and now. People loved Bernie Sanders' message, but they were not convinced that he could win. The Democratic establishment positioned itself as having credibility and a leg up in that area. Because they've lost to Trump twice, the voter base that despises Trump goes, I don't think I believe you, so I might go with the guy that actually is saying things that I like in terms of policy.
A lot of these Democrats that we see running now sort of became Bernie Sanders Democrats during that race. And so you see this come to fruition here. In Michigan, one of, I think, the real worries is that Abdul El-Sayed is maybe not as a competitive a candidate against the Republican who did really well last go round. He used to be a fellow contributor here at CNN.
Mike Rogers, very telegenic.
I think he lost by something like 9,000 votes or something like that. that. And so there is real worry. But you know, this is about attitude, right? It's about passion. It's about media training in some ways. I mean, if you think about somebody like Abdul.
It's just funny what concerns get aired. Like, I have a real concern that a insane Zionist, Christian Zionist, in the person of Haley Stevens, that I'm not going to comment too much on the personality stuff, but I have concerns about that as well. And the amount of dark money just in general she's taking will turn people off in a general election. I have concerns about that. Why don't we ever talk about those concerns?
Well, they're pretending like the centrist is the better candidate in the general election. It's just not the case. I mean, the fact that she's going to be tagged with all of her AIPAC support and then have to go into the general election in a state that the Democrats insisted they had a leg up on in the 2024 race for very similarly arrogant reasons.
Judea and Samaria.
That was about maintaining a donor network of Zionists and other big money. You think those problems are going to get less salient with Haley Stevens at the top of the ticket? Give me a break.
Media training in some ways. I mean, if you think about somebody like Abdul El-Sayed, also a fellow CNN contributor at some point years
before he ran for governor and lost in the governor.
And so there is a sort of energy and polish, I think, that some of these candidates are bringing that the more sort of centrist candidates aren't really bringing that.
Why can't you guys talk about the policy? Why can't you talk about the policy resonating? This Troy Jackson thing in Maine will be a real test because he is going to have a very similar platform to Graham Plattner. And but, you know, maybe less of the charisma and less of a name recognition at this point because Plattner had been running for over a year. But if he's able to pull this off with just that platform, I don't want to hear anything about this anymore. Yeah. Like, that will be so dispositive. It'll be ridiculous. Like,
Troy just won because of his overwhelming charisma.
Yeah, right.
In Troy's defense, I would say he has what I call Northern Maine charisma.
Yes. Well,
let's do a think piece on it for the New York Magazine.
Is he a part of the toxic Bernie bro left when you talk about charisma? The only charisma that counts is if you sound like Marge Simpson and you're having some sort of like manic episode about Israel. That's the charisma that they care about. Just to round this out, because I mentioned that we're going to be talking about the proliferation of bot campaigns and influence campaigns on the internet. This was over the weekend, all over Twitter, and it wasn't just this instance of accounts that are more centrist were saying something extremely similar about Haley Stevens. You got Tim Miller here. Okay, yeah. She's growing on me and I can't help it. A lot of these accounts just said the same exact thing. I have to admit it, Haley Stevens is growing on me.
Like an infection.
I like how they have to admit that
it started from a low place.
Yes. Don't kill me, but she's growing on me. Guys, Haley Stevens is growing on me.
That's what you say about like a weird sort of new food.
Right, right. I've tasted it 3 times. Like I'm supposed
Marmite,
to.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, she's grown on me. And it wasn't the only instance where there have been like a lot. There's been like a lot of identical phrasing that has been tweeted out or sent out on social media.
Oh, this is it's always great when Zionists think they have a point.
Right.
Or this noun verb APAC put by.
Yep, that's the new one. Noun verb APAC. That's what they're sending out to these influencers. I think. Look, again, noun verb
Eli
APAC.
Lake, big time loser.
also, noun verb APAC. I wonder how they all came up with this. Noun verb APAC. God,
they are cooking over there. And
I mean,
support Israel.
Yeah, like I keep referencing this big Wall Street Journal piece, but they talk about how, if you guys remember Brad Parscale, he was the senior digital advisor for the Trump campaign in 2020, and prior to that, in 2016. He was the guy that oversaw the Cambridge Analytica strategy, which essentially was this firm. It was revealed that this firm improperly took personal data from tens of millions of Facebook users to build psychological profiles to target them for right-wing causes. And this happened in the 2016 election and in Brexit in the UK. And Parscale was across that. he was brought back for in the Trump campaign in 2020 and then had to kind of leave in disgrace because he had a total psycho episode, or I shouldn't say psycho. He had an episode of domestic violence, allegedly, with weapons, and his wife called the police on him. And now apparently he's been contracted by the Israeli government to run an influence campaign here in the United States. And I'm not saying that, like, someone like Tim Miller's getting paid by a corporation to tweet that out. But we get press blasts from other campaigns as well, where they'll say, these are the talking points. This
what
is what
email
we want to hit.
You on?
Right. What email? But do I think that maybe smaller, like what we saw from Taylor Lorenz's Chorus reporting, these smaller influencers, perhaps they're getting paid and then they're on the email blast list and then they send out social media posts that are in keeping with these talking points. It's just something to keep in mind, because I think we're really in a period of unbridled corruption in so many parts of what used to be, you know, institutions that were more defensible. And this so-called free speech space on the internet is now pay to play, much like a lot of our information ecosystem right now. And so something to watch as we cover this key Senate race in Michigan.
That is grandma.
That is grandma, baby. That's Brad Parscale. Parscale is so grandma. In a moment, we are going to be speaking to Kira Kiefer, who wrote the book Unvaccinated Under God, Religion and Vaccine Hesitancy in Modern America. But first, a word from some of our sponsors. Have you ever thought I really should be doing something to protect myself from scammers, from stalkers, from hackers, but you're not sure what to do? Well, I've got the answer for you. Go to www.deleteme.com/majority and enter code MAJORITY. You'll get 20% off. Delete Me removes your personal information that is being sold online. Before I even started at the Majority Report, I had heard about Delete Me. I was at a different company, and I was, you know, starting and putting my face out there, my name out there, and I was like, how do I hide my personal information that is a little bit sensitive from weirdos that want to Google it? And I was immediately recommended Delete Me, and I've been using Delete Me for I don't know, close to a decade at this point. In the age of AI, we are all especially vulnerable to scammers using your personal data that's floating around the internet against you. Have you ever Googled yourself and found your home address, phone number, or the name of a family member? It can be unsettling, but the good news is Delete Me can help. Get an individual plan for a little over $8 per month. Discounts get even better with a two-year-old plan or when you enroll with your partner or family. Delete Me does all the hard work to wipe your personal information from data broker websites. Thanks to Delete Me for sponsoring the Majority Report. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now with a special discount for our audience, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority and use promo code MAJORITY at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority and enter code MAJORITY at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/majority, code MAJORITY. Link to that down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Gotta say, great service. Can vouch for it myself. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority and use promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Another word from another one of our sponsors, Rocket Money. You know, Rocket Money has been super helpful for me because I'm just trying to get some of these subscriptions that you have and you've, you know, maybe forgotten about canceling, etc. On your card, they automatically renew and they can slip by without you thinking about it really easily. Rocket Money is helpful to keep your everyday life on track, keeping track of what and how much you ordered online, for example. Rocket Money has automatic transaction categorization across accounts, plus customizable categories and tags to reveal spending patterns. You know, if you have a big purchase or you want to save up for something in your life, Rocket Money can be helpful to help you save for that, just to get your finances in order and to have a better sense of it. Because a lot of these companies rely on you not thinking about it. Rocket Money helps you do that. You can have automated savings. It helps you with that, that allow you to grow towards goals with adjustable amounts and frequency, set it and forget it approach for Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that you can really get behind and just is beneficial for you when you're trying to get a handle on your finances and all the little things that might go under the radar. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join rocketmoney.com/majority. That's rocketmoney.com/majority. rocketmoney.com/majority. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. rocketmoney.com/majority. We will put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. And lastly, we're always thinking about plastic around these parts, not just the stuff we throw away, but the tiny particles that we don't see. Plastic doesn't just disappear. It breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces that stick around in our environment. And I'm trying to worry about microplastics here at home. I know we're always worried about it here at the office. Sam is harping on it all the time. And that is why Blue Land has become a staple both in my home and here at the office. Because while we hear a lot about microplastics in ocean and food, they can also come from the products that we use every day at home. Blue Land makes dish, laundry, and other household cleaning products designed to reduce single-use plastic. They've got their cleaning tablets that are 100% plastic and microplastic-free. They are independently tested to perform alongside major brands, and the formulas are made without dyes, parabens, or harsh chemicals. So you also don't have to repeatedly buy new bottles because you just use the tablets and it helps you cut down on waste at home. Blue Land is trusted in over 1 million homes, including mine. And I guess, you know, we double dip here because the office has Blue Land as well. We've got our dish cleaner over there. Hand soap, the everyday all-purpose cleaner. I mean, pretty much every product in here that's for cleaning is Blue Land. Blue Land's laundry tablets are a microplastic-free formula made with plant and mineral-based cleaning ingredients. They're hypoallergenic and safe for sensitive skin. They're proven to tackle tough stains from grass to food stains without the bulk jug. But they've also got dishwasher tablets, as I mentioned, proven to perform on burnt-on, baked-on stains without rinse aid. Toilet tablets proven to work on a wide range of stains, including rust, limescale, hard water, and more. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Make the switch today. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/majority. That's blueland.com/majority, blueland.com/majority. We will put a link to that down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Kira Kiefer. We are back, and we are joined now by Kira Ganga Kiefer, visiting assistant professor of religious studies at Wesleyan University and author of Unvaccinated Under God, Religion and Vaccine Hesitancy in Modern America. Kira, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. So happy to have you. Happy to dive into your book here because I love how you look at vaccine hesitancy, particularly in the U.S., from a really different angle than we, you know, traditionally cover it, I think, and a lot of people traditionally cover it. Your contention is that the narrative that vaccine hesitant people are merely ignorant of, you know, just science and scientific facts is missing a huge part of the story. What is the part of the story that's missing there?
Yes. So thanks so much for bringing that up. So the missing part of the story is that people have had contentions or fears or concerns or anxieties. I kind of use all those different words about vaccines since they were invented in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century. And so that has always been the case. And so when we look back historically and then also now, we can see that they're not always about the same exact issues, but yet we see a lot of kind of higher meaning questions, not questions about do the vaccines work or don't they work, or is the science there to support the efficacy of X vaccine or Y vaccine, but rather like, is it a morally good thing for me to vaccinate my child if there is some level of risk to do so? And what kind of like risk management is any individual running? And so when I think about risk, I think about morality. I see religion everywhere. And so religion, not necessarily in the institutional or doctrinal sense, but more in a subtler religion, as I call it, that works into people's calculuses when they think about vaccinations, especially for their children, but also themselves.
And so viewing it as a form of religious expression is interesting because we've talked about, at least on this show, about how Trump kind of takes on the contours of an evangelical, you know, sort of televangelist, and a lot of his support is in that base. And you have prosperity gospel, but you have the skeleton of very identifiable and familiar religious expression in the United States that appears to also be able to be mapped onto a lot of vaccine hesitancy. Would that be fair to say?
I think it's maybe a fair assessment now and in the past couple of years, and I would include COVID through today, but not necessarily earlier. And so when we think about how I like to think about religion is not only in that like evangelical or Christian sense, but if we broaden it, then we'll see that starting in the 1980s, which is when my book begins its history of modern vaccine hesitancy, we do see a lot of the kind of evangelical narratives or tropes about what's right and wrong and protecting children, protecting the family, and also the use of conversion narratives that people use when they are becoming evangelical Christians. And they say, like, I was lost and now I'm found. Like, Jesus has saved me. I understand the world better. So we saw that happening in the 1980s with the DPT vaccine, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, when there was a kind of an expose documentary that came out in 82, and it was alleging that there were, you know, more injuries from that vaccine than there should have been, so to speak. And a lot of parents came forward and said, oh, this seems to reflect my story. My child has been sick, has been injured, and now I understand better because the doctors hadn't told me that could have been the reason, that could have been the cause. Whether it was the cause or wasn't, it sort of doesn't matter, is what I'm kind of, is my argument here, is because they were making sense and meaning out of inexplainable events. And so we see that like idea of like evangelical tropes there, but not necessarily like a Christian, like an ostensibly Christian. And it wasn't like ostensibly Christian at the time. And then as we move forward into the 90s and 2000s, if you remember like the MMR autism theory and like Jenny McCarthy and talking a lot about the MMR measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which we're hearing a lot about these days as well, there was not overt religion there. There's a lot of discussion of like bodily purity. And that purity was about protecting from the sickness that could be you know, transferred through the vaccine, not like of what the vaccine could be protecting against, but rather like this fear that the vaccine itself could be toxic or have chemicals in it that could make the body dirty or impure and then therefore ill. So there's like there's this ongoing like fear that vaccines do more than they say they're going to do, so to speak. And I think that's where meaning making is so important, and where religion plays into our, you know, kind of history of vaccine hesitancy. And to get to your point now with Trump and him, you know, acting as a, you know, religious type figure, yes, he does represent a lot of evangelical Christians, and that is his base. And in the more recent history, in the 2010s, we saw evangelical Christians becoming more engaged on vaccine hesitancy as a medical freedom issue because of very clear ties to threats to religious freedom laws, so to speak, where with the idea of removing religious exemptions from vaccines, which means that there hadn't been a truly religious or like Christian reason to oppose vaccination. But then suddenly when there is more vaccine hesitancy, fewer people are getting vaccinated in the 2010s, 2015, 16, right around Trump's, you know, coming into power, evangelical Christians see that there is, you know, a cause that they can get on board with, and it kind of brings them into the tent of vaccine hesitancy.
Well, how would you then characterize, I know you write about Gardasil and the HPV vaccine, which, you know, I remember because that was around the time when I was supposed to be getting it, when that was being rolled out. And I remember the, you know, more conservative parents in my school being against it, and there being, you know, this idea that it was promoting promiscuity. And that was my first real association with vaccine hesitancy and the religious right. So my question for you would be, why not start that, or would you start the, you know, merging of kind of evangelical resistance to vaccine hesitancy then, or why say it's more, why did it escalate more with Trump later on in your view?
Yes, so you're correct in saying that when Gardasil came out and hit the market in 2006, there was a conservative evangelical and Catholic kind of like outpouring against that vaccine in particular because it's against certain strains of HPV, which is a sexually transmitted infection. And the way that the vaccine was marketed was as a like a cancer vaccine, as a way of trying to make it so that young girls wouldn't eventually develop like cervical cancer. They didn't talk about it being sexually transmitted in the way of the disease. And so Christians got a hold of that and they became very incensed, as you point out, and were against having that vaccine be mandated for all children. But I use that as sort of as a very interesting case study because we see that like kind of overt religious involvement, but they weren't really concerned about the vaccine itself as much as the behavior that they thought
promiscuity. Yes,
that it could potentially green light for young girls. And so I would say that that was more of a function of like sex, like purity culture and like concerns about sexual mores, than it was about the vaccines. And so like that uproar died down pretty quickly. It was effective because lots of states did not mandate it. And it still isn't mandated for most children or young adults, but, it was a short-lived moment, I would say. It really becomes part of the kind of evangelical white evangelical Christian conservative MAGA identity around that like late 2010s moment that I was talking about before, because there had been all of these measles outbreaks starting in like the 2010s, like I was mentioning, and that caused honestly liberal states to consider revoking religious exemptions to mandatory vaccines, saying we don't think those states like California, New York, were saying we don't think that it could possibly be that people who don't want a vaccine are doing it for, you know, religiously sincere reasons. We'll just revoke that entirely. That clause is outdated. We don't need it. That will ensure that people have to get vaccinated. And even though even most evangelical Christians had been going along and been vaccinated and had not seen this as a like religious problem prior, when they heard that idea of the religious exemption being taken away, it put up, I think, antennas for lots of leaders in that party and in that group. And they said, oh, that's a religious freedom issue. We already fight on behalf of religious freedom as evangelical Christians. That's one of the big ways that we are heard in American culture. And that is a way of kind of pushing back on liberalization. And we see that vaccine hesitant people have a longstanding cause that is separate from ours. And now they're kind of pushing into like medical freedom and religious liberty as well. So they see a coalition, I think, or at least like the makings of one. And then surely it pans out and becomes a coalition. It becomes part of, you know, conservative Christian identity by the time that COVID hits, right around COVID hitting. I don't think that would have happened. I don't think that, you know, a third of Americans would have said no to a COVID vaccine 10 years earlier. I think that all of those things had to have happened prior to set that up.
And how much of that would you also say is a failure of public health in general in this country and churches and kind of, you know, religiosity, which we should also separate from some of the wellness religiosity that is similar in character, and I want to get to it, but doesn't have a formal, say, evangelical structure. Like, how much of this is filling gaps because our public health system is so anemic, so poor compared to other industrialized countries, that this kind of almost like religious freedom cowboy mentality is able to take root?
Well, lots of things going on there. I think that I really do find areas to critique, for sure. You said anemic. I in terms of the public health system, because I think that people in public health had seen vaccine hesitancy, which I was talking about, you know, earlier in the interview just a few minutes ago, as having started much earlier than the 2010s. But when it gets to the 2010s, they address it as, a failure of facts, so to speak, and that they need to just like address vaccine hesitancy with more facts and also, you know, changing the laws. And those things really, those two methods really actually triggered vaccine hesitancy or anti-vaccinationism amongst a lot more Americans than otherwise would have, because it seemed to be derogatory. To say that lots of people didn't understand the science, and therefore, if they just would listen and, you know, go to school, they would know that vaccines were good. And also was kind of threatening, or at least posed to be taking away the right to get an exemption, or just the right to, you know, say no to the government on something. And without realizing it, I think public health made vaccine hesitancy much, much worse, is what I would say. Is that's how I feel about it. That's how I read it historically. You know, of course, we don't know how things would have been had vaccine hesitancy been understood differently in the prior decades. But we do know that amongst, say, African-American populations who also have higher levels of vaccine hesitancy than white populations based off of, you know, different factors, medical racism, that when public health and doctors talk to them and make partnerships with African-American communities and say, like, we see you, we see the damage that we've done in the past, we want to try and rectify that, we want to gain your trust, we see that being effective, not necessarily in taking down all the hesitancy, but in bringing up uptake, certainly during the COVID vaccine or the COVID, you know, pandemic. Whereas with like white evangelicals, I think they were seeing this the COVID shot as an opportunity to oppose, you know, a government and a system that they didn't like.
Right. I mean, I guess that the question is then for me is how is that ground made more fertile? And, you know, the fact that this hesitancy is fairly, I would say, American in character in the way that you describe it would, I would say, my hypothesis would be, you know, what is the structural issue here that would, that creates this, this circumstance? And the United States is unique in many ways, but in terms of healthcare, we don't guarantee healthcare as a right. And so when it does that not increase skepticism?
I couldn't speak to that. I don't know if it would, if that increases skepticism, but I hear what you're saying. And I think you're absolutely right that there is this, you know, we have a very strong American individualistic culture that is, you know, lots of people and kind of like ingrained into our culture is to be oppositional or to be suspicious of the government and of anything that seems like socialized medicine or, you know, guaranteed healthcare.
But yeah, even the deprivation in and of itself might also, you know, increase skepticism and make people feel like these other institutions are more likely to, I trust them more than a public health system, for example.
Absolutely. Right? Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I think it's absolutely the case that there's at least a very strong sense of distrust of doctors and of the medical establishment that's been growing, especially with, and it doesn't necessarily tie specifically to evangelicalism, but this is the group who has kind of taken it on now. And also concerns with big pharma and seeing that feeling like, you know, the medical establishment, so to speak, isn't taking care of them. And we could see like lots of, we could go back and think about many different, you know, policies that could have been different and changed where we are now, but we have what we have now. And yet there is still, with all of this quote independence, there is still a lot of skepticism towards, you know, doctors and public health and wondering like if they have people's like best interests at heart. And I think that gets at people from a cultural perspective and also a religious perspective. Also thinking like, hey, I actually put more stock into folks that are, you know, more openly like me or church leaders that are more openly like me that are, you know, Christians that talk about God. You know, there's all different ways of framing, like, why are we healthy and why are we not healthy and who should we trust when it comes to taking care of ourselves?
Your book mentions, you know, also talks a bit about how specifically on the in the 90s and early 2000s on, you know, the measles, the MMR vaccine, how middle class women were kind of brought into the vaccine hesitancy fold, or just women in general, mothers, mm-hmm. during that period. Can you talk about that dynamic? I mean, I think you mentioned Jenny McCarthy, but it occurs to me that when, you know, you mention the Tuskegee experiment and black men being, you know, experimented on and then being killed and medical racism and some of these other groups that are more vaccine skeptical, perhaps mothers are being not necessarily talked about enough given medical sexism and misogyny and what women have to experience with the medical system that might cause them to be more skeptical of vaccines for their children, because so oftentimes women are not listened to about their pain and don't have doctors treating it seriously, it might create that opening.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is a crucial part of this history and of this story, because women and mothers are the primary people who are dealing with vaccines, because most vaccines are for children. Mothers make those decisions, right, for the most part. certainly historically. And so in the 1990s and early 2000s, we see like this confluence of factors that I think are getting at exactly what you are saying. And it's this increasing pressure on especially white middle-class women and moms who are feeling it the most, I think, in that moment where they are now in the workforce thinking about, you know, like kind of after the second wave feminism, they're back in, they're in the workforce. They are trying to have it all. They're being moms. They're working. They are, you know, have a tremendous amount to shoulder. And then they hear about this possibility that a vaccine could maybe give their child developmental delays or some sort of neurological disorders. And, you know, this is a reputable study, a study published in a reputable journal at the time in The Lancet in 1998. And then it gets picked up all over. And it puts into these women's, puts on their plate this big moral dilemma, which is like, who do I trust now? And what is the thing I need to do to take care of my child? And at the same time as dealing with like kind of the after effects of second wave feminism, which brought out a lot of that medical sexism that you're talking about and how misogyny is very much baked into, you know, the history of biomedicine in this country and in all of our, you know, public institutions, they were also being kind of hit with intensive mothering as the paradigm where it was like, you need to take care of every single aspect of your child because your child is who represents you. Your child is like a near sacred being. We need to be absolutely certain that there is no impurities going into your child because this is what's most important. And so if that's the ideal in mothering idea is intensive mothering, and you're learning about, you know, these possible side effects of a vaccine, and you know that the history kind of is against you as a woman in the medical system, and you know, you have the, you know, high likelihood at the time of feeling like maybe you wouldn't be listened to, and you hear lots of other mothers saying, you know, I went to my doctor about my child's pediatrician about their reaction, what I think was a reaction to a vaccine. And they just said, oh no, you're wrong. And that story is repurposed over and over and over again. And it's extremely, you know, it hits hard. It hits deep for moms who are like feeling like they're held to the highest of standards in terms of like having this like spiritually and physically like perfect child that they are in charge of. So I definitely think that, and then I see that intensive mothering as very much being you know, an effect of anti-feminism of the 80s. So of trying to get women to focus more on the home and less on work. So I think that, you know, sexism is a huge focus of this, of my book, certainly. And of, the vaccine hesitancy history. We have to look at like who is hesitant and why, and what are those systemic issues that are at play?
Well, really a fascinating angle, a much more compassionate angle than we sometimes get on vaccine hesitancy, but it's key because everything is systemic. And, you know, when, if we're trying to promulgate public health. I'm sorry, my camera, it appears to maybe have frozen, guys, if we could just find that, or we might be back. We're going to have to understand people and meet them where they are. So really appreciate your time today. Kira Ganga Kiefer, visiting assistant professor of religious studies at Wesleyan University, author of Unvaccinated Under God, Religion and Vaccine Hesitancy in Modern America. We'll put a link to that down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. With that, folks, we're going to wrap up the free part of this program, head into the fun half in just a second. Just wanted to mention this. Matt's coming back soon, but it has been 6 years since the great Michael Brooks has passed away. We're thinking of him today. We're thinking of his family. We think of him often. Every day. It's been 6 years, which I can't believe, but rest in power, Michael. Love you, buddy. And yeah, Can't believe it. 6 years. We'll make fun of some Zionists maybe in the fun half in Michael's honor.
Let's see if I can wrestle up a Sebastian Gorka clip.
Yes, exactly right. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Luckian media universe?
Yeah, we had a sort of, a show of many different moods yesterday for our Sunday show listeners, where we did some fun stories and also ended on Stephen Miller and Marco Rubio and all these people getting very McCarthyite, which I think we can look forward to over the next few years. Tomorrow we'll have a show probably talking about some of this Jasmine Crockett stuff and other stuff over on Left Reckoning. So, yeah, that's coming up tomorrow.
JoinTheMajorityReport.com if you can. Become a member. Support this program. JoinTheMajorityReport.com.
We've lost a lot of members over this Will Lawrence blowback, so if you can please join.
That's the crazy. They faced a lot of blowback, and I thought they were going to talk about Blattner. And I'm like,
oh, wait, what?
You didn't in the CNN clip. They were talking about
the blowback Bernie
face.
Yeah. Will Lawrence, right.
See, you couldn't even. That's how little blowback.
I know.
You didn't even know what we were.
Well, David Dayen had an interesting write up about. I guess you know the. He was targeted as in this like really cynical way as anti-black, and apparently the community in Michigan was like, we're not buying this, and he still got the backing of some of the leaders that,
as the CBC condemns Will Lawrence, local black leaders back him up. So I mean, that's the sort of inside baseball thing we're talking about
right
here, whereas like I mean, I think fairly typical of the CBC but also like nobody heard about this besides people that read, you know, the Prospect.
Exactly. But you can check out, if you want to hear about this controversy, you can check out
the blowback.
Yeah. The American Prospect.
I like how we use a word like blowback as we're like basically on the cusp of a wide war that's going to cut off shipping through the middle of the world. Like that's genuine blowback.
Yes.
The spat between the black establishment and local black leaders over a white politician running, like, I don't know, man. I think maybe we got some bigger fish to fry.
I think so, too. All right, guys, we will head into the fun half now. We'll probably take some calls today. See you there.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
Yeah, I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
So it's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Tour,
sushi, and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Who's offered a tour? Sushi, and
that's what we call the biz.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour, sushi, and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Well, look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about him. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
So it's offered a tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Tour. Sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Tour. I think I'm like a little kid.
Add this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. Think I'm like a little kid. Think I'm like a big tour.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job.
Tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. Willy Wonka tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offered a tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. That's
a tour?
A real thing.
That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. That offered a tour?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Tour? Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy.
going on. Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders. Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time to bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump violet twerp.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, she wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of the on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
Hi, Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
We are back, folks. It is the fun half of the Majority Report.
I'd like to give a public service announcement that you can just go ahead and mute Fred Gutenberg.
Who is Fred Gutenberg?
That's just not really important.
That's what I said, too.
Okay.
Yeah, because he's a father of a Parkland victim who is also very keen on smearing everyone as anti-Semitic. So just mute him. You don't need to deal with that.
All right, interesting.
People are like Mehdi Hasan, like, I appreciate, you're right. You don't need to say the guy's name because, he clearly has stuff to work through.
I thought it was the guy from Police Academy that you were talking about. Isn't that guy's name Gutenberg? That's for Sam. Sam, come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just for my old references.
Californian resistance. Emma, in social media, I got bashed as racist for being in DSA, Hasan Piker, and Abdul in Michigan too. I put that down fast. Sure seems to be a trend. Center Dems attack, of course. You think they're feeling threatened? Yeah, we'll talk about that. I think, you know, they're using every tool at their disposal right now to disparage and discredit the left and divide the left.
It is the cynical weaponization of identity politics that the left, particularly socialists, have been talking about forever.
All right. Well, this is actually, now that we're here, let's do 12. Friend of the show, Bhaskar Sankara, went on Ross Douthat's podcast, the New York Times's Ross Douthat, who, you know, in this interview, Bhaskar does phenomenally explaining the vision for a socialist world, both long-term and short-term in terms of what democratic socialists want to achieve here within the Democratic Party, but more broadly what socialism would look like as an alternative to capitalism. Douthat spends an inordinate amount of time fixating on the culture war and wokeness and where the left went wrong. And what I love about what Bhaskar does here is he corrects the framing about which part of the Democratic Party actually used divisive tactics related to identity politically. So part of this answer has gone a little viral. I backed it up a little bit more to get Ross's framing in here, where Bhaskar says, actually, it was 2016 with Hillary Clinton that is where this really began.
Which is ironic because Hillary Clinton also started the Barack Obama birther thing in 2008.
Darkened his skin in ads, was responsible for leaking him in that traditional Somali garb to the press to drum up Islamophobia. Huh.
Because this is politics, and there are people, even on the Democratic side of the aisle, that will use any sort of weapon they can, regardless of what it means or how it's situated in America's history.
Best or one of the best places for immigrants on the planet.
So to some extent,
wait.
It does sound like you think that the left took a wrong turn in sort of peak woke early 2020s culture war. And maybe the wrong turn was partially just talking about America like it was the most racist country in the history of the world. Like what's basically, was there a turn that the left took in that period that socialism can help correct?
Well, I actually blame more the center and the center left for a lot of these things. And I think that it was a Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016 that tried to draw these extreme contrasts. I remember Bernie Sanders was killed because he had an ad with a Simon and Garfunkel song on it, America.
They only play an extra weekend. Yeah, I think.
Because he ran this ad right before the caucus in Iowa in the primary in New Hampshire, and they said, there's too many white people and it's too rural. Is this your vision of America, socialist?
I'm Bernie Sanders, and I approve this message.
So I think a lot of this came from those directions. I also think that...
Just
I would just add, was before Dalta said anything here, Hillary Clinton literally said, would stop being the too-big-to-fail banks, which I would say is one of the more urgent political economy issues of that election... Would stopping too big to fail end racism? That's a literal argument she made, but we'll I'll let that continue here.
Just so people are aware of this, this is a really interesting part of what happened in Democratic politics, right? The Hillary Clinton campaign, which was the more centrist campaign or perceived that way, really did sort of try and use identity politics issues against Sanders. It's true that the center sort of tried to weaponize identity politics against the left. But the left didn't necessarily resist, did it?
I think by the time he ran in 2020, Bernie did try to frame more things. His old universal demands he kept, but he would explain why they were good often in terms of closing disparities.
Right. Racial.
We need Medicare for all, and Medicare for all is anti-racist because disproportionately it's going to help uninsured people who are black and brown. And, you know, at a certain level, obviously that's right. But it seems like a weird way to pitch a universal program is talking about, you know, disparity. But I would push back on just one thing you said, which is America was the most racist country in the history of the world. And I think the left actually does a great discredit to its own history when it pretends like it still is, because we're a country that fought a revolution led by the left, in my opinion, that abolished slavery by force of arms, not slow and gradual emancipation. We fought against Jim Crow, and we got rid of that, also with socialists largely, you know, at the helm, or at least playing major roles. And then we got to the point where we elected a black president. And that black president won even the state of Indiana in 2008. And it just seems so strange that it was, in part, the election of Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton that convinced so many Americans, so many liberals particularly, but even some leftists, that America was irredeemably racist when those same voters had just voted for a black president twice. So in a way, I think I want to recover some of the optimism about the U.S. we felt during the Obama years. And also, for what it's worth, that my parents still feel about the U.S. as so many immigrants, Latino and other immigrants feel about the U.S., which is they came here for a reason. This is a good place. This is a good country filled with, by and large, good people.
You know, I thought that narrative, look, he's admitting, of course, that America still has racism and has a long way to go. But the emphasis being there's more that unites us than divides us is a lot more politically salient, especially in the time of nihilism and cynicism, when people are desperately looking for a positive vision of the country. And so to reclaim the left's history, we should include the liberation struggles for slavery, also the organization and fight for civil rights in the Jim Crow South and the desegregation, and Martin Luther King Jr. being a socialist, for example, and an anti-war activist, and seeing that as intrinsically linked to the struggle for black liberation in this country.
Call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all of God's children.
Right. And correcting the record about how, Ross being like, well, the left didn't actually, or the left didn't eschew it, you know, essentially. I'm paraphrasing what he said about the cynical weaponization of identity politics. As if, like, the left was supposed to push back on that when the headwinds against the Bernie Sanders campaign were already so significant. And the left is actually earnestly sensitive to issues of racism and is intersectional and understands that that Black Americans and other groups in this country have been systemically oppressed and discriminated against, and that disparities in wealth are a direct result of that.
The 2008 financial crisis and the recovery that was largely presided over by Democrats and with Obama at the head, Black wealth was completely wiped out after the financial crisis. Before right. and after, it's nuts. Like cut, like huge, like, I can't remember like if it's half, maybe that's overstating it, but Black folks particularly were wiped out by the collapse of the housing market. And there's no sort of like, maybe we should have done something different. It's all this, well, we're actually the ones who aren't racist and the Republicans are racist. There needs to be a serious effort to look at why, because guess what? Trump won the most recent election, increasing his margin in those communities, which yep. doesn't say he won them, obviously, but he increased his margin there because the Democrats are not credible on these issues.
And when there was a poll that came out about Maine, and it was something like less than 20% of Maine voters saw Graham Plattner as too left. And now you can draw a case to the fact that, like, you know, again, that campaign, like RIP, we're on to Troy Jackson now. But you can look at his policy positions and say, like, they are to the left of the average Democrat. Now, there's an indicator that some people might say, okay, he's not far left because he's a white guy. And those are like implicit biases that we're going to have to confront. Like Kamala Harris was seen as too liberal. And that was basically because California, Black woman, boom, there you go. But, you know, there also was a different way of doing politics. And you can communicate left-wing issues in a way that doesn't make people feel like you're too liberal in the traditional sense when you lead with it being a forward, the universality first, and then stand up for marginalized groups as well under that umbrella. The best example of this is Zohran Mamdani. There's nobody in this country, in terms of elected officials, that stands up for trans people more than Zohran Mamdani. There just isn't. But it's never the headline because his programs of childcare, of free buses, of taxing the wealthy are what's foregrounded. And when you have that as your base of support, you can win one of every 10 Trump voters in New York City. And it's not going to be motivated by bigotry, like where your base of support is, or dividing and conquering, like liberals and conservatives want us to engage in. Yeah. It can be built on an economic populism that allows you to have the political capital to stand up for Black and brown people, for trans people, for gay people, what have you, under those auspices. It makes you a stronger political force, which allows you to stand up for people who are on the margins.
It's the difference between doing any of this stuff out of principle versus doing it as a cudgel, because in the moment, it's useful to hit your enemies with.
Right.
And look, like in the moment, you can use, tar somebody as a racist and get them out. If they're actually racist, great. That's good. But ultimately, if you don't deliver for people, you're going to wear out the sort of effect of that appeal. Because if you get in and it's like, okay, we got rid of the bad guy, but I just ended up bailing out the banks and giving all this money to big tech and your jobs being destroyed. And all you had was to point out rightly that the people have problematic attitudes on this or that issue. Well, you're lining that issue up to take the brunt of what people resent come like your failed policies.
And also, I would also say that the collapsing into America is the most racist country on the planet, which, again, this is not to say that this country doesn't have immense problems with bigotry and racism, but it also allows for liberals to have a bit of an out in terms of trying to appeal to voters that they wouldn't traditionally try to appeal to with a more economic populist agenda. Once again, a guy like Dan Osborne comes up a lot in this interview, and Bhaskar brings him up, rightly so, where I don't like his immigration platform whatsoever, but I understand he's running in a state like Nebraska, and that is and he focuses on things like right to repair, right, which is extremely salient in a state like Nebraska, as Bhaskar points out in another part in the interview, but somewhat like a socialist in New York City might not be across that. And that is a part of the left-wing agenda as well, is bringing those people in, and understanding that when you have an agenda that puts working people first, it allows us to protect marginalized groups across the country more effectively, because then they're also a part of the same coalition.
There's only one durable majority in this country, and that's working people.
Yep. Right. There was another interview that the New York Times did with Zahra Mamdani, which we'll get to, I think, at some point. But she really pressed him, the interviewer, to say, like, are lawyers are in the same boat as, like, this kind of worker? Except it's like, is it a threat to you that the definition of working class is expansive? Because I think it is. Like, and
well, it's a divide and conquer. It's
yeah,
basic.
Right. I mean, and liberals did something. They do that along professional lines. And then they also sometimes have, and since the Hillary Clinton campaign, have engaged in it on identity lines. And I don't think that it's made race relations in this country better. Like, I mean, it has made it worse, in part because the tactics, people began to see how bad faith they were. And in the absence of an agenda that was putting working people first in a sincere way, that they were repelled by this very cynical usage.
I mean, look at the Abdullah Saeed thing, calling him a misogynist, as you have a candidate like Haley Stevens taking dark money and pro-Israel money. Like,
right.
That, what are people going, what message does a normal person take that is being used so cynically?
Right. It's the same. It's the same stuff about, like, how could you not know that Kamala Harris would be better about Gaza? I don't know. The actions of the administration. I mean, treating voters like they're stupid has not borne fruit. And yeah.
Do you want to play Andrew Tate Get Interested?
Yes, I'll read some IMs and then we'll get into that. More Adventurous says, the corporate back center left wants people's only choice to be them, representing the status quo and the right wing. I like the fact that DSA is giving people another option for blocking the far right and wants to get things done. Yes. Tempe from Maryland. I think on the left, we do need to fight to reclaim optimism and maybe not patriotism exactly, but a belief that this country can continue to chase the ideals that were hypothetically put forward at its founding. People want to join an optimistic movement, not a movement that only talks about how bad things are. I think that was a lot of what Bhaskar had to say there.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think there's a certain part of where a certain tendency that any, frankly, ideology can get into, where it's just about deconstructing what actually exists rather than figuring out how to construct what you actually want.
Right. Woods from Chicagoland. Where the hell is Sam? It doesn't take this long to record 13 lines Hugo has in the next season of Bob's Burgers. Well, could be a different assignment.
I thought about starting a rumor that he's the next Spider-Man.
Spider-Man?
Hey.
Sorry.
Hey.
Sorry. If he was here, that'd be even better.
I denounce Brian. I would never, ever associate with someone with such horrible views.
I stand by it.
Can somebody mock up a poster for that?
Spider-Man? I mean, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Hopeful One says, God damn it. I have to admit I'm smart and trust science. In the 90s, when I held my daughter, I hesitated about vaccines after hearing so much. I am thankful I had a wonderful pediatrician who calmed my fears, and we went ahead with vaccines. I get the fear when your baby is terrifying. June Oliver, my parents only became vaccine skeptic during COVID, and this came to a head when I received my COVID vaccine while pregnant. Meanwhile, a friend of mine got COVID while pregnant and nearly lost both her and her baby's life.
It's really horrible, the amount of messages that people got. And I think there's like the sort of free speech shit about COVID. Like, I think that stuff where people were complaining about, oh, you're not letting me monetize talking about how anxious people are about the vaccines. If you believe in it so much, you should do it without YouTube ads getting sold against it. And then 5 years later, we have people being put into ICE detention for writing anti-Palestine or anti-Israel op-eds or endorsing them anyway.
Right. All right, let's do this. So Andrew and Tristan Tate have been arrested, And I mean, the outfit that Andrew is wearing here. Let's just put it up.
Yeah.
I mean,
I thought this was AI. It's too perfect.
It is a beautiful woman's blouse, and he is, of course, wearing loafers with no-show socks. I mean, those things probably stank.
I wonder how much that chain costs.
How much ankle does one need, by the way, to show off?
Put your ankles away.
Exactly. I mean, what happened? Have a sense of propriety, you rapist. Okay, let's watch these guys getting taken into custody because the UK has some new charges against them.
From the Telegraph. And you think Tate's wearing something funny? Watch this guy that comes up to him.
Oh my god, he's wearing pleather pants. Oh. Phone, give it away. Andrew Tate's wearing pleather pants. Or I'm sure they're leather.
And his brother's dressed like a smooth criminal.
I thought, to be honest, I thought that was someone in religious garb. I did not know
look
that was Tristan.
Guy.
Oh,
look at that jacket.
The substitute UFC announcer.
I mean... Is that Pat McAfee?
This is what should be... This is what we're supposed to... Like, young men are supposed to aspire to.
Yes. Look, I mean...
Check my chain.
Do you think that this pat-down gave him gay thoughts?
He's just like Liz Warren,
Yes.
Right. But
the
without...
Pants?
She's always wearing a blazer.
Yeah, without the blazer. Yeah.
Like, look, as someone who's... I love committing to a look. Like, I have these tank tops, and I have them in six colors, and I cycle through them. Liz Warren has, like, four jackets, and then black tank top, black pants. And, yes, that is one of her favorite colors. Yeah.
I remember when he was first getting in trouble for, like, the sex trafficking stuff in the UK, and it seemed like an open and shut case. Like, when I was at jury duty, I saw cases that were less open and shut than that. Like, him just boasting on his website that he would, quote, make girls fall in love with him and then make them, like, film stuff, like, cam for him. It's what a pimp sounds like.
Well, I mean, he should have been, he was supposed to be brought on charges, him and his brother, in Romania. And part of why he had escaped the law for so long is because Barron Trump is a fan, and Trump let him back into the country.
Mm.
These actual predators. I mean, we had one of the interviews that we've done that sticks out the most to me is, I forget, it was called Clown World or Inside the... I'm going to look it up. About Andrew Tate. Andrew Tate, here we go. There was a book called, Clown World, 4 Years Inside Andrew Tate's Manosphere.
Mm-hmm.
People should go back and check out that interview because these two guys, like, went inside of the Manosphere for a while and, you know, went to visit the compound where they were, Andrew Tate and his brother... were holed out and witnessed, you know, some of the human trafficking and stuff in real time, and how they kind of rope these men in to these rings, these insecure men that just start paying for this service because they're trying to get women. And as we've talked about with the Manosphere, it is so antisocial, it is so misogynistic that the tactics that they're teaching them are not going to yield good results in the long term, in terms of alleviating their loneliness, and then they just go back to pay more and more and get hooked into this scheme.
It's like drug dealing.
Yeah. And so, yeah. Oh, you're rejected again? Well, sign up for more courses that are going to get you laid.
Learn about how it's their fault.
Yeah, exactly. and, you know, we'll sleep with all of these OnlyFans models or put them on display, but at the same time, we'll talk about how disgusting they are and how you should degrade them. And, like, you may find this hot, but you shouldn't actually feel any sense of empathy, and don't let any doubt creep in, which is another hallmark of conservative thought. Don't let doubt or empathy creep in. We'll create all these barriers to that possibility. And we'll set up a situation where this sex object is inherently dehumanized and come into our little pyramid scheme. There's, like, all of these Manosphere people have essentially been bringing in these OnlyFans models from parts of the world that don't have a lot of economic opportunity and taking advantage of them as glorified pimps.
Yeah.
And taking cuts out of the work that they do, the labor that they do. because they give them a platform, and then they basically own a percentage of their work in perpetuity,
yeah,
and take advantage of them during that time period.
I mean, it's similar to like the COVID sort of anxiety capitalization that we saw in media. But I mean, when I was a teenager, there was pickup artists, and it was harder to monetize lonely men at that time if you were a pickup artist, because it's like, okay, I can keep sending them brochures or like access to a forum, or like maybe I can get them to spend money to come out to Vegas, and I like, you know, take them around clubs and tell them like, hey, go say this to this woman. But now Andrew Tate and people like him can just sit in front of a computer and just sell ads against this stuff all day, and online memberships. It's much easier for these sorts of people to monetize what's essentially picking a scab in people's like social inabilities. Like they're not developing actual. I mean, this is probably a broader problem. People are socializing less and being online more, and it is you actually seen this come to like a problem in the real world.
Well, I mean, for all the talk of the male loneliness epidemic, perhaps there can be some finger pointing at the people that are exacerbating said loneliness. Like, we talk about how, yes, capitalism and income inequality is a main driver here because people don't have any opportunity to have free time or have comfort, or like their standard of living is not going to be what their parents experience for the most part. So that creates a level of, you know, economic anxiety too, that makes people more susceptible to exploitation by things like this. But big tech is a big part of this too. They've created a lot of knowingly addictive algorithms to keep people atomized and isolated and on their phones. And then they'll sell you the solution. Like the Google glasses or whatever that was, the Meta glasses that we covered last week. The glasses that can tell you and that can do facial scanning of everybody in your orbit so that you know you won't, you know, have their name forgotten, as if that's the worst thing in the world. Like, don't worry, this technology will protect you from social embarrassment. And the reason that you can't even handle the prospect of social embarrassment is because you're alone all the time and you don't have any socialization. And the kids that came up through COVID, you know, which is a real shame, but isolation was necessary given the pandemic severity. But like, they are also immensely susceptible to this. And there are studies that are showing they have difficulty with socialization. And these guys are targeting teenage boys and have been. Maybe they're less in vogue now. It's more Sneeko or whatever, these other streamers. But the adjacent manosphere people are targeting these boys who already have social deficiencies due to the circumstances of like their most formative years.
Yeah, the type of boys who are going to sit and watch a lot of content.
Yeah. So the real problem though is Hassan Piker is really the lesson.
Also, like how Florida's just turned into Tel Aviv, where like all these rapists just run there to live.
Yeah.
Like Russell Brand. Andrew
I mean,
Tate.
Where was Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, yeah. It's not Miami, but like Donald Southern Trump, Florida is a lot of weirdo Zionists.
I am curious how the politics of this played out. And where like the DeSantis administration was and stuff on it, because it was a little bit of a problem for him when they.
No, DeSantis was pissed at
Trump.
Right,
exactly. Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, what?
And he went.
I want to. I don't know why I'm doing Jimmy Dorfer on DeSantis.
Well, I'm just trying to articulate how pathetic that piece of shit is. He was upset with Trump, but you know that's the extent you're going to get about it. God, I love that guy's political career is over. That's the one good thing about Trump, is he's destroyed so many Republican hopefuls.
DeSantis' initial response was declared that Florida does not welcome the type of conduct associated with the Tates.
Yeah.
I thought about guilty until proven innocent, Ron.
Right.
Or whatever. He clarified that he had no prior knowledge. Just, yeah.
Okay, well. I'm sure he's thrilled about this development.
I honestly, it's fun. I'm curious. I hope Trump gets pissed or something, or that one of the Trump sons, like, you know, supports him or something.
I think Don Jr. is friends with them.
No.
I might be wrong.
I'm shocked they get along.
I know. What would they have in common?
Has there been any response from those guys yet?
I don't know. Labor Churchill, Florida, a sunny place for shady people. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, that's why Miami is never going to be New York. Like, they pretend like...
No, it's going to be Atlantis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, you want to do this Trump thing?
15. Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Which number is this?
15.
Okay. Oh, my God. Yeah. So, tomorrow we're going to have Trita Parsi on the show to break down the latest developments on the Iran war. But last week, obviously, the United States resumed this criminal war on Iran, bombing civilian infrastructure. Iran retaliated by hitting the Gulf states. There's escalation in terms of targeting of desalination plants, etc. And the biggest escalation in quite a while from Iran's side is, one, they bombed Saudi Arabia for the first time in months. Two, they have now pulled the Houthi card, which is essentially enlisting the Houthis in Yemen to help block what's the name of the strait? Mandeb is part of it.
Babo Mandeb.
Babo Mandeb Strait. There we go. They've enlisted the Houthis to do that, so choking off another key trade point, this time in the Red Sea, as a way to continue to put economic pressure on the United States, because Trump, clearly, now that we know, after this memorandum of understanding has been, you know, declared moot when it was close to expiring, that once again, this administration is using diplomacy as a ruse for its own objectives. The U.S. and Israel have done this repeatedly. Oh, lulling Iran into this false sense of security via diplomacy and then, like, killing their leaders or bombing them out of nowhere. And we think we're really tough when we do that. The same thing with the MOU, because the stockpiles of munitions in the United States was extremely low at that point. And this created a pause in fighting. But because Iran has won, and has won so far this conflict, the terms that the United States has had to agree to were so disadvantageous that Trump only, in his view, has this option except to escalate. But the midterms continue to approach. Gas just hit $4 a gallon and is increasing. Crude oil just hit over $90 a barrel for the first time in around a month. So this is just going to get worse if Trump doesn't disengage and essentially surrender. And on top of that, we now know that at least 3 SUS service members have died in the past 9 or so days since the resumption of hostilities. A 19-year-old, girl from Texas, and then there was a really young man, at least in terms of the identities. I call her a girl. I know she's a woman, but, God, these are kids. Yeah. They're kids.
Let's see if I have the picture.
I mean, that have died because we decided to go to war for a genocidal rogue state. And our idiot president was convinced by Benjamin Netanyahu into engaging in this.
Yeah, Israel wanted to hurt its enemy. And now this girl who was born the same year I graduated high school, Isabella Gonzalez, is dead. So she looks like she's 12.
Exactly. I mean, that's when I say kid, I remember her face from seeing it. And you just think like, yeah.
Are we doing child soldiers now?
Basically.
It's depressing.
Horrible.
And also, just broadly, before we get into the thing of this, we've spent so much money on our military every single year. Everyone knows this. And the Pentagon will never pass an audit. So we have this idea that we've invested in a global fortress and we have bases everywhere. These bases are like shipping containers that will not withstand even like a grenade. So all of these troops over there, they're not in these massively reinforced, safe locations. Yeah. That's why they had to retreat to hotels in Dubai when this war started out. Like, we've been had.
Yeah. And,
by the military industrial complex.
And the reality is that Trump, instead of caring about U.S. troops, what they've been engaging in so far is, as has been reported, the slow walking and covering up of the extent of injuries and damage, and even in terms of the death total. They're delaying that information as much as possible because, like with COVID, Trump just cares about the PR. He doesn't care about people dying. Are you kidding me? If we don't report on COVID, it doesn't exist. If we don't report on U.S. service members dying, I'm winning the war. Don't worry about it. Here is Trump responding to a question about these service members being killed.
Well, we feel very badly, but, you know, those great people, those great patriots were out there fighting that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. Iran has been very, very badly damaged. They've lost everything almost militarily. They've got very little.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
how are they killing people if their military's been destroyed?
It's a good question, actually, and I have a late addition to a clip on that. Maria Bartiromo, one of our favorite... I mean, the Edward R. Murrow of...
I was thinking more of a Muppet.
Well, sort of
Fox
the...
Fox Business Muppet.
She's the female Fox News host who didn't get appointed to a high-level position like Jeanine Pirro did as, what, D.C. U.S. attorney or whatever. Maria got the short end of the stick, but she's still carrying water over there at Fox News. And this level of idiocy, they're in a... I mean, even she's in a cult, the way that she seems genuinely confounded by this. I saw this over the weekend.
I don't understand how it's possible that Iran has the capabilities to fight this way and continue to try to lash out at Gulf countries and U.S. military bases, because the U.S. has obliterated Iran's military, and the president continues to reiterate that. I don't understand.
Actually, what I said, Maria, if you listened, was that we decimated it. And if you look at the definition of decimate, it means cut by a tenth only.
I said like totally, not totally, like similar to totally, but not completely totally.
I love when a journalist goes, I can't understand this. The president is claiming one thing.
I yeah, exactly.
And the other thing is happening.
And the thing he's claiming is a completely unscientific and unverifiable like use of language, like totally obliterated.
I mean, the way her mind is blown, that perhaps the reality doesn't match what the dear leader tells you. Like, you're supposed to be a member of the media that's critically investigating this, Maria. I know that's kind of laughable if we're talking about that, but...
But again, like, do people need to know what these locations are? Because it feels like there's just a basic... Let's see if I can pull up this image here. Understanding of, like, what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Iran completely, like... You could not give them a better target
right
than the Strait of Hormuz. And then this idea that they would take Karg Island. Again, like, how are you going to stop them from this entire range just sending drones down at troops?
Immensely mountainous. They can't even find the nuclear facilities that they say that they're targeting in those mountain ranges because they're so effectively hidden. It's also where a lot of their military infrastructure is, and they just have a geographic choke point. What's amazing is for all this freaking talk about the nuclear weapon thing that Trump keeps hinging it on because he has to see himself as the peacemaker and
the other people like war.
What did Melania say? The peacemaker and unifier. Yes. And he has to see himself as that way. He's like, you know, we've got this MacGuffin, we've got the nuclear dust, the nuclear weapon, and we're going to take them. They don't need it anymore. What's amazing is that you've actually made it so that that doesn't matter. And they can give that to us in negotiations to the United States, and they'll still have been victorious because they've now demonstrated that their geographic leverage, as you point out, Matt, is sufficient to make the West really hurt.
A nuclear weapon, like what you can do, like a terrorist attack on a enemy city versus... I can bring the entire world economy to its knees
yes.
with drones that cost like a Honda Civic, and I could launch them just at ships and scare them from trying to pass. And the American military can be like, actually, it's still open. Well, a lot of those boats don't seem to want to risk it.
Well, yeah, insurers are like, no, we're not going to insure this. That's the bigger problem. They're not going to, these big insurance companies are like, screw you. Like, end this war. We're not like insuring these ships going to go through the Strait of Hormuz. And the United States spends, its military spending is a third of the entire planet's military spending as one country. We have not won a war since World War II in any real meaningful sense. So Maria Bartiromo is like, flummoxed at the idea that the claims from the United States president about U.S. military supremacy and having an efficacy aren't true. Like, girl, do you remember Vietnam? Do you remember Iraq? These were pretty big debacles that the United States didn't win.
You actually aren't allowed to work in media if you have long-term memory to the extent that you remember that actually all this money we give towards the Pentagon every year is a big fat fucking waste of money.
Yeah.
And it's actually not even as Pete Hegseth says, making us this fighting force, or as some liberals like to say, like, you know, the most lethal military on earth.
Oh, Kamala, flashback.
It is a con played by these companies, yeah, where they get massively rich and just assume no one's going to challenge us. But when you try to actually solve problems this way, they turn out to be much bigger. Like, this Strait of Hormuz thing was never a problem.
Yes, although, but for Israel, their problems, they see their problems as distinct from our problems.
Yeah, and they want to turn everyone into rubble. That's the way they want to fix their problems.
Let's reframe the nuclear weapon issue just for a second for people. Israel has lots of nuclear weapons, okay? It's the only country in the Middle East that has one.
And yet our lawmakers can't be honest about
right.
that.
Right, and they can't be, and they lie about it. Why are they so afraid of Iran having a nuclear weapon? Do they think that really Iran's going to nuke Israel and drop it on Tel Aviv and then risk the United States nuking Iran in response? No, they don't earnestly think that. But having a nuclear weapon is the most powerful deterrent against two belligerent nuclear actors that choose to bomb the country of 90+ million people at will, whenever the hell they want, lie to them about negotiations, try to entrap them, kill their leaders, and more. So if you're Iran, why wouldn't you try to develop a nuclear weapon? The only reason you wouldn't now is because it may not even be necessary.
Yeah, or you had some sort of religious icky feeling about it, which, you know.
We'll see if the younger leader now has the same, you know, compunction about it that his father Khamenei did. But we shall see. I'm excited for our conversation with Trita tomorrow to hash a lot of this out. Dragon Rider, Christian Cole and Christian Taint in 1 week. Men can take this. Rhaenyra at it again. I'm trying with House of the Dragon, guys. Christian Cole is a very handsome actor that does help things,
what
but
is
man,
House of the Dragon?
the Game of Thrones sequel. It's just not that good.
Is it like a fashion show?
It is not House, H-A-U-S of the Dragon, although that would be cool.
That would be hilarious, a version of House that takes place in the Middle Ages. Like, I think it's witchcraft.
The cast is is really good. Like, I will say, Emma Darcy, Olivia Cooke, and Matt Smith, and plus the guy that plays Christian Cole, they're all really, really good, but and the Sea Snake guy. But the story is just, the source material is not there in the way it was for Game of Thrones. In the same way that, like, the show got a lot worse when the book material ran out.
I haven't seen any of it.
That's Well, I'm on an island here.
The green screen stuff just makes me check out.
I understand. There's a lot more dragons in this, and I care less about that. I like more of the politics.
I thought that's what you were saying to sell it.
No, well, it is the selling point. Like, part of why the show, the original show, also deteriorated was they stopped caring about the writing and just cared only about the dragons towards the end of the show. And it really showed.
Speaking of Christians, I want to check in with a Christian nationalist pastor, Josh McPherson, here. Because we've been talking about alpha males and, you know, Christian Tate and all that stuff. He's got some new advice for folks. I don't know if you know what tithing is.
Yes, of course.
Paying the 10% to...
What, he wants 100% tithe now?
Well, no, but the stakes are higher than you could have ever imagined.
Okay.
Some of you have been claiming to follow Jesus for years and years and years. You're coming to this church and you don't give a dime, or you tip God when you remember to. And as God is my witness, men, with all the love in my heart, you know I love you. You know I love you. You may not like what I say, but you cannot say I do not love you. If you're sitting here claiming to be a stronger man and wearing the...
I'm sorry, but... It's like what the most abusive partner would ever say.
Yeah, exactly. I don't believe you love me.
I'm treating you like shit, but you cannot say I don't love you.
I'm very suspicious of whether or not you love
me. Right.
I think you might hate me, actually.
I cannot say I do not love you. If you're sitting here and claiming to be a stronger man and wearing the gear, and you are not tithing to God through this church, and you're some alpha male that likes to look down on all those gay sex men, Just know that God views you and those men as the same.
Wait.
If you don't give me money, you're a gay sex man.
A gay sex man. That's my new comic book.
I gotta say.
Sex man?
Gay sex
man. It's like X-Men, but gay guys.
Coming at you rock hard. Why did he go there? Why did his brain go there? Gotta wonder.
Because of the Bible, Emma. Obviously. There's nothing else going on that might motivate those sort of thoughts.
You're no different than a sweaty gay sex man coming at me.
Let's get that one more time.
Gay sex man.
And you are not tithing to God through this church. And you're some alpha male that likes to look down on all those gay sex men. Just know that God views you and those men as the same.
Oh.
Sit here on your high alpha male horse.
What if you're a gay sex man that tithes?
Right. I gotta say, it seems like he's trying to reclaim the valor of the gay sex men from somewhere deep in his brain. He's like, they're just as bad as all of you out there. We're all in the same boat.
So if I spend my weekend with them...
Yeah. Don't we have
Save as spending a weekend with you.
Don't we have a sound drop for this for this particular circumstance?
Sorry, which what are you thinking of?
I'm sending it now.
Okay.
And just keep playing.
Let's play this a little more, yeah.
To God through this church. And you're some alpha male that likes to look down on all those gay sex men. Just know that God views you and those men as the same. Don't sit here on your high alpha male horse looking at all these perverts out there having sex with men when you withhold from God his tithe. God views that man and you as one and the same. You're like, are you trying to shame me? 1,000% I'm trying to shame you.
I like that he specifies tithe through this church.
Yeah.
If you don't tithe through this church, then you're a gay sex man.
I'm just as bad as a gay sex man.
Just as bad. You're no better.
Out West is gonna need to change my IM name to gay sex man.
Can I just say, like, even if you're it's hard for me, like, you shouldn't care, but like, looking down on the gay sex man,
not alpha,
why are they occupying your mind at all?
Sorry. I mean, man, they really reveal way too much by accident. Ronald.
I like picturing somebody being like, "Shit," and then grabbing their wallet. Like, I'm not a fucking gay.
I'm not gay.
Here's all of my money.
Right. Starts making it rain.
You're gay if you don't give me everything that's in your wallet right now. Man.
Yeah. If you don't join the MajorityReport.com, you're
a straight sex man.
You're no better than these.
You're
straight,
not even trans.
Straight sex man.
You're not even
cis sex man.
God sees you as the same as those heterosexuals.
Yeah, exactly. And aren't they disgusting? I think we can all agree.
Also, like, he's dressed like he's on Duck Dynasty. Like, I remember when pastors used to dress up a little bit. Wasn't there like robes and stuff you're supposed to wear?
That's us being Catholic.
Okay,
that's not what these guys.
I can't hate on that stuff. Like, I'm all in favor of the NBA coaches not wearing having to wear suits or anything anymore. So. I mean,
they're closer to God than these pastors are.
He is in drag, though.
Like, yeah,
this is man drag.
Oh, totally.
It's
the
same drag Matt Walsh wears.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that.
This is the type of guy that was wearing a fedora in 2013.
Yeah. So was Matt Walsh, coincidentally.
Yep, exactly.
Silicon Valley leftist gay sex men will return in Avengers Doomsday.
If you're one of these guys constantly looking down on these gay sex men.
Who is that?
Oh shit, my ears are burning. Yeah. Constantly looking down on those guys.
Red River Valley says, only tuning in for the fun half today. Did I miss Emma's coverage of the World Cup? I guess we'll cover this just really quickly because it's funny. The World Cup final was yesterday. It was a really exciting match, and I was worried that I found myself, like, Francesca Fiorentini is a good friend of mine. She's a big Argentina fan, but I just couldn't do it. I was rooting for Spain, especially when I saw Ben Gavir come out and root for Argentina. I was like, all right, we're all we're all in on Spain, and they outplayed Argentina the whole match. And then it went to extra time, and I was like, oh my God, if this ends in some like fluke accident that gets Argentina to score a goal here, or they go to penalty kicks, this is going to be the most outrageous way for them to win. And it turns out Spain was able to pull it off in extra time, and they were the better team the whole day. And Trump, of course, was in attendance with Infantino in the luxury box. He was playing with the trophy before they gave it out. He was caught on camera, which is against FIFA protocol, of course, but the dear leader had to touch
it. Protocols are made to be broken.
Exactly. And by the way, this is where the Giants play, and they brought in real grass for the soccer players. So it turns out they can do it. And you don't have to cheap out and have all your players tear their ACL on this
ACL in the NFL.
On this crappy turf. But, you know, that's a conversation for another day for the owners of the Jets and the Giants. But Trump tried so hard to get on stage with them and be in a photo op, and it was as cringy as possible. There were multiple players on Spain that have openly spoken out against him, have also spoken out for Palestinian rights. And so here is Trump trying to get in on the fun. Okay, yeah.
I think he was just excited because he thought they all worked at McDonald's.
Yeah. I took a quarter pounder, Ronald.
And there's that's Infantino, right? Coming over. And he tries to sort of like
get him off.
Let's
stage.
Go, Donald. I got the momentum going this way. You're going to follow me. He's like, okay, no, I'm actually going to be by these McDonald's boys.
Yeah.
And then again tries to remind him.
Look, Donald, an Argentinian player just took his shirt off.
Right.
The Argentinian cheerleaders are over here, Donald. Come this way.
So, this is the millionth, or the, I don't know, fourth or fifth time since he got reelected that he's tried to do this. Yes.
He loves it.
He loves it so much.
I mean, he'll never top falling asleep at game three of the NBA Finals.
And cursing the Knicks, I'm telling you now, it was better than them sweeping the Spurs, that being the only, for my political agenda, that being the only game that they lost, because the vibes were so off that night. And by the way, no word after James Dolan triumphantly told the New York Post that they're definitely going to the White House.
It's been radio silence.
Radio silence since then. It's almost like the players don't like him, openly tweet about how they hate Trump and don't want
to
go.
Also, shout out to Red Sox legend Mookie Betts, who said he will not be going to the White House with the Dodgers.
There you go.
He better go into the Hall of Fame as a Red Sox. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, I think given recent developments, I don't know. I mean, this Dodgers team is pretty special, but I haven't been following much baseball because the Mets are so pathetic. But anyway, Teishu, both Game of Thrones and Stranger Things suffer from husband, executive producer, and wife head writer or editor divorcing before the series end, and the wives bounces from the project. That makes sense. I also think that Stranger Things, after that first season, chose to like not focus on Winona Ryder anymore and just focus on the kids because Netflix thought they were cheaper to hire. And when it was more for adults, that was when that show was good. But
yeah, tough. A little bit childish.
Yeah.
I mean, at risk of starting an entirely bigger problem, kind of like a lot of anime in my experience.
Wow, Matt. I am not touching that.
I've tried so many times to get into these shows.
I am not touching that stove.
Can we get some that's made...
He just besmirched all of anime.
I didn't say all of anime. I said a lot of anime. Seems to be made for teenagers.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like Cowboy Bebop. It's a great show. I wish more of it was like that. And less like, oh, I'm a teenager. I'm angsty. Sorry.
We need more controversy. Oregon lefty, I was one of the unfortunate young people who got messed up by COVID. My freshman year of college went to full online the second semester, and trying to relearn how to socialize was one of the biggest challenges I've ever had to deal with. And I'm thankful I had places like MR Hassan's show to put me out of the right-wing chud pipeline. You guys are making a huge impact. I love that. Glad to hear. And I wonder if like kids from that era will write a story about... write about what it was like.
I think it affected more than children. From like, this is a stand-up point of view. This is clearly anecdotal, but touring before stand-up and touring before COVID and after COVID, people just start, their social skills are gone. Like, people just talk out loud. They yep. take phone calls. They, like, do, like, they're just, like, they you, live in so, their own head.
You were telling me that we both saw The Odyssey this weekend, which I did really like. You said someone took a phone call in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, I was in the, yeah, a guy was, like, having a laughing phone conversation. The whole theater was screaming, shut up at him. And he was trying to argue with everybody in the movie theater. But, like, the inside voice got destroyed, I yes. think, in COVID. Like, I don't know. At least in audiences, in my experience, they're just talking out loud now.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Let's open up the phone lines here, 646-257-3920. We'll take a call or two. Evil woke communist Matt hating all of anime has really made me leave the left. I
didn't
say happy.
All of anime, but it is a problem I have with a lot of it. I've tried to get into it, and I just find it, like, a lot of it is whether explicitly about kids or teenagers, and I don't know. I like adult. Like, content. I'm 37 years old.
Todd from Raleigh, Emma, House of the Dragon is way better than Game of Thrones. Let's be real. It's way more focused and way less horny. It's definitely less horny, and they do have female directors, well, which out, is then. Making a difference. But
the whole point of the first one was right, softcore pornography.
And I will appreciate the female gaze, especially in, you know, sex scenes and stuff like that, which is so lacking. But that doesn't save the show from not being as good as Game of Thrones for me.
Do you guys remember when Terrence Howard said it ruined him?
No.
Because all it just got him into incest.
Right,
oh, that's right. Because everyone got obsessed with incest.
He tried to say everyone, but
right. it's kind of like our pastor friend.
Exactly. Everyone's thinking it, right? Calling from an 801 area code. Who's this? Where you calling from?
This is me.
This is you.
Hi. Long time, first time. Wait. Does my mic sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So I am Sean. I'm calling from the heart of Ozarks, Springfield, Missouri.
Gotcha.
And I want to defer. I guess I have two things I want to talk about. The first thing is I want to talk about some ballot initiatives here in Missouri. So I know we probably don't have that many listeners from Missouri, but there's two really important ones, numbers 4 and 5. Number 4, there's a little bit of backstory. You guys covered it on the show. Number 4 is about future ballot initiatives. It's essentially an amendment that will make it so ballot initiatives are practically impossible to pass. So the current system is that if there's a ballot initiative and it gets an overall majority in the state, it passes. But now with Amendment 4, if it passes, it'll make it so that even if one of the congressional districts votes no, it will not pass. So, I mean, there's at least a couple districts in Missouri that basically will always vote no on any kind of progressive or even just, you know, any kind of ballot initiative that will make it basically impossible to have any democracy in the state. So that's worrying because the Missouri House or the Missouri Congress already found a way to bypass a previous measure that was for legalizing abortion. Mm-hmm. And I think this is them trying to essentially permanently get rid of that option in the state.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the heads up. That's always helpful because it's sometimes hard to track some of these ballot initiatives.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call, Sean. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Let's see. Calling from a 207 area code. 207. Who's this where you're calling
Maine.
From? Maine, I guess.
Hi, this is Evan from Maine.
Evan from Maine. There we go. Ryan. Brian. Your name's Brian, not Ryan. Brian picked up on it already. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I want to talk more about Troy Jackson.
Nice.
I'm a volunteer on his campaign.
Congrats. Yeah. And great job in Maine, the left coalescing around Troy Jackson and, you know, making the most out of a really, really difficult circumstance. Because he was clearly the best available option from a left-wing perspective as a candidate to go up against Collins.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I've actually been saying since the whole tattoo scandal that it should have been Troy Jackson from the start, to be honest. And, you know, everyone likes to dig on Troy for his, you know, his charisma. But as I think, not sure who it was, but someone on the show, Rex said, called it what? Like Woods charisma? Like Maine
Woods
charisma?
Probably Brian.
Yeah, I would, if I were talking to you, I would have said it's the county charisma.
County charisma. Yeah, I think that's
up there in goddamn Aroostook.
Yeah, yeah. I think that works here. More people think it does. I think Graham really speaks well to the issues, and he can really stay on topic and all that when he was running. But Troy comes off as really, really down-to-earth, caring, kind. And I think that that's an important part of politics. I mean, a lot of politicians forget about these days, you know? Like, they come kind of just, like, strong and just like, oh, I know everything, you know? But Troy is, like, down-to-earth and understanding, and I think that works with a lot of people. Works with me, at least. Of course, I'm a socialist, so...
Well, but he's had an interesting background. You know, he was a Republican, I think, in the late 90s. Then... But, you know, he was a logger, a union guy, came up through that kind of political ecosystem, and then eventually just has for now 2 decades been a Bernie-associated, union-associated, left-wing candidate or politician in Maine. Mm-hmm. And that track record is significant.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people talked about Graham and his ability to kind of, like, pull maybe, like, young men back in the coalition. I think Troy Jackson might be able to do the same thing in some ways. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with, like, you know, Maine electoral history, but, you know, this guy, despite being a progressive and not throwing anyone under the bus, at least not, you know, since he changed his views on abortion about 10 years ago, he still continued to win in Aroostook over and over and over again while Trump was on the ballot, even.
Right.
So this whole idea that progressives can't win in rural areas or can't win in red areas or purple areas, yada, yada, yada. I think Troy will be a really good use case of totally blowing up this entire sort of liberal idea. I think it comes down to messaging. I think it comes down to vibes, unfortunately. I think it comes down to, if the politician seems authentic, it comes down to, you know, platform.
Yep.
I think that progressivism can work everywhere, and I think Troy Jackson is going to show that. And honestly, I think this is really a great outcome. I've been kind of like, ever since the tattoo scandal, I was like a soft Graham supporter. You know, I was like, yeah, I vote for him, but,
right,
you know, I'm a little bit skeptical, whatever. Like, I was never like, you know, a Graham hater, but wasn't like a Graham cheerer either. But then after, you know, dropped out, I immediately contacted my people with Troy, which I worked on his governor campaign. I'm like, we gotta move. And just the results, 480 delegates, which I am one, is just an amazing result. And you literally could not be happier with the result.
Well,
especially because the, you know,
yes,
the guys running against him, Shaw, was just actually just like a total stooge. So,
well, people should read, of course, you know, David Dayan on top of this with the American Prospect. Jackson, as you say, so congrats on being a delegate yourself. Jackson Slate won the majority of the vote in 15 of 16 counties, and in most counties, including the biggest, Cumberland, home to the city of Portland, his Slate won every delegate. Overall, he took more than 90% of the delegates, according to a review by The Prospect. And this essentially means that when there's the convention in, I don't know, I guess 5-6 days, it's not even going to be a question, because even if all of the committee members were to unite behind one candidate to go against Jackson, that level of delegate, you know, victory means he just essentially has a supermajority. So they can start, you know, we can start going Jackson versus Collins now, you know? I mean, that's going to be the race.
Exactly.
Caller, yeah. are you DSA?
I am DSA,
yep. Well, how are socialists feeling about Jackson? I mean, just maybe now or, like, over the governor campaign? I'm curious on that that perspective, because that was always the interesting thing about him versus Plattner is, I think for a lot of the reasons you've already mentioned, Plattner was never going to get a DSA endorsement. How are the socialists up in Maine feeling?
Yeah, so I should be really careful with this because we have not made an endorsement for the Senate race. We
right.
did endorse him for the governor race, but there's a very different kind of, you know, roles. But what I can tell you is that the vast majority of named DSA members really like him, but there is some concerns about, you know, he's not a member of DSA,
yeah.
But we've worked with him in the past on a variety of different things. And we it's a very respectful relationship and we like each other a lot, but there is concern, you know, on does he deserve the endorsement? Because if we endorse him, he'll then basically be part of the, you know, the coalition of DSA endorsed, you know, Chris Robb and Millet Heroes and all these other new DSA electeds. And does Troy Jackson, not being a member, does he, you know, deserve that endorsement?
Right.
I believe he does, just because I think he's always approached us in really good faith. But we're going to have a meeting soon, I can't say when, on discussing this, on whether or not we should endorse him, but it's in the works.
Interesting.
That's all I can say on that.
Cool.
But yeah,
last
there's
question.
A lot of stuff for him in the chapter, for sure.
Can I ask you something? How is he resonating in Southern Maine? Because everybody's talking about whether or not he can reach Northern Maine, but I think that's a given. And Southern Maine is significantly larger population.
During the governor's race, he won Portland, which I was amazed by. I'd recommend you checking out the results in the first preference votes and the ranked choice. He won Portland. He won Bangor. He won, you know, his home area by massive margins. I think he might struggle more in York County, just because that's actually where Susan Collins beat Sarah Gideon a few years ago.
But I think with
the whole tragedy in Biddeford, people are really waking up and are really, really mad at Susan Collins. I'm not sure she can like pull it off this time because people are so, so upset.
But she has so much charisma.
And right. And is battle tested her way. That was Janet Mills. All right. Well, this is a very encouraging update. Appreciate the call. Thank you so much for, some optimism out of Maine, which was a little bit of a tough, it's been some tough weeks there, but again, just to wrap up our call here, it's a real test about a progressive platform versus the person and the amount of media attention. If Maine can pull this off, there were a lot of people that were quite excited to hit the left over the Plattner thing. If you can pull this off with Troy Jackson, the amount that we will be insufferable in kind in response to that will, I mean, at least for my end, will be pretty seismic. So I appreciate
the call. Go back to Emma saying she hasn't learned a single lesson.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
I will continue to put myself out there emotionally. And there you have it. See ya.
Thanks, Emma.
Bye.
Can I say one more thing real
quick?
I'm about Graham Plattner. Just to repeat, we did not endorse Graham Plattner. Graham Plattner is not a DSA candidate. He is just a progressive guy that a lot of Mainers liked. So I'm very tired of hearing that he's a DSA candidate.
Agree.
We are so tired of it.
Agree.
So thank you.
What we have to say to that is that this.
You are not a New Yorker. You have no clue.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Emma.
Thanks. All right, guys. I think we'll take some more calls. Apologies. We just took two quick ones, and people weren't on the line for too long. So that will be our call portion. Militant Apathy. I don't believe that progressives can win in rural areas in any Confederate south of the Mason-Dixon line, sadly. Well, that's for now. That's for now. I don't agree.
What do you say basing that off of?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see about Dan Osborne has some progressive things in his platform. How do you define a progressive? I think that's there's a difference there.
I think that is a far too categorical statement.
In addition, okay. The amazing Grando. Word on the street is that Matt besmirched all of anime while God considers you and the weebs to be the same.
I don't consider you to be my mayor.
Daisy, as a high school teacher, both before and after COVID, I'd like to let you all, especially Brian, that audience's issue extends to students. I've had a student answer a spam call in CA.
Jesus. First of all, that should not... Take the phones out of schools.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Classroom, like, it was not allowed when I was in school.
Right. But maybe we should just do age verification that big tech wants to do instead of taking phones out of the schools.
Gosh, put there's lockers. I what are we talking about?
I know.
Underbags.
I know. Well, I mean, they say it's a safety issue, but then
in case there's a school shooting.
Yeah,
come up with some sort
of safety, have an emergency phone in the classroom or something.
I'm sorry.
That's such a weak argument.
That's horseshit. That's using the problem with school shootings as a way to keep phones in the kids' hands of kids in schools. Yeah. There's no way that makes you notably safer to have a phone to be able to be like, yeah, the cops aren't doing anything and we're still under lockdown. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do three and then that'll be a filter into this clip, which, what number is this?
Four.
Okay. So the Wall Street Journal had some reporting from over the weekend that is really fascinating and not at all surprising. But they dug deep into Israel's $50 million experiment to change U.S. public opinion. That is the headline from the Wall Street Journal, reported by Maggie Severns, John Dossi, and Natalie Andrews. And it opens like this article. The text messages come from senders named Emma or Sarah with a group called Friends for Peace. How do you think the U.S. and Israel's peace talks with Iran will impact global security, they ask. Millions of similar texts have flooded American cell phones in recent months. They are written with artificial intelligence, shocker, pushed by a longtime Trump advisor's firm and paid for by the Israeli government. Some 60% of Americans now have an unfavorable view of Israel, according to a March poll by Pew Research, driven by its handling of its wars in Gaza and Iran. And then just a little bit down to the artificial intelligence paragraph. The artificial intelligence texts are one piece of a more than $45 million contract that the Israeli government recently signed with Brad Parscale, a longtime ally of President Trump. Israel set a 2026 budget of more than $700 million to expand the country's efforts to shape consciousness and improve its image around the world, Foreign Minister Gideon Sa'ar said late last year.
They seem to have a lot of money to spend on dumb bullshit. Maybe we should stop giving them our own.
Well, I mean, exactly. It frees up. Where's they can that give free health care and they can give
free IVF.
Yeah, all this stuff in Israel because we're paying for their military. The Israeli Foreign Ministry didn't respond to interview requests. Its allies argue that its influence campaign is necessary to counter those run by Iran and the pro-Palestine movement, which is just showing the reality. The existential threat to Israel is misinformation from any side, Parscale said in a recent interview. He denied any effort to undermine U.S. negotiations. Israel has retained at least six firms to help with the effort in the U.S. over the past year. 36 new people, many of them marketing professionals, have registered as foreign agents for Israel. The country is on track to spend more than any other on U.S. influence disclosed with the federal government this year, said Nick Cleveland Stout, a friend of the show, a researcher who studies foreign lobbying at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Other countries, including Qatar, have spent large sums over the years on influence efforts. Now, we'll return to Parscale here to zero in on him. His work has come under scrutiny given his role as chief strategy officer at Salem Media, a conglomerate that hosts popular conservative podcasts and radio hosts, including Hugh Hewitt, Scott Jennings, who I've tussled with over Israel's genocide on television.
They ever mentioned that on CNN?
Shocked that he, does he disclose that he's a part of Salem Media, a Zionist operation that is currently getting in contract with the Israeli government? Scott Jennings and Lara Trump.
Connect the dots.
Well, let's pause here for a second, and then I want to go to the Israel's efforts extend beyond Parscale, because there's another piece that I want to make sure we touch on. But Parscale is somebody whose name you'll be familiar with. I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the show. He was Trump's senior digital advisor in 2020, and he had to kind of leave the campaign because he had an event where he was incident where he was involuntarily hospitalized. Apparently there was drinking involved, and he was in the streets and there were weapons, and apparently, allegedly, he was threatening to harm himself. But prior to that, Parscale was the guy, the digital strategy campaign guy in Trump 2016, that oversaw the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which showed that Cambridge Analytica a firm associated with the Trump campaign harvested the personal data for 87 million Facebook users. I think, you know, it might have even been more, but that we know of, to build psychological profiles of them and target voters that would be ideologically aligned with Trump, and also Brexit. This was used in the UK as well. And this was improperly gathered data, and it was this massive scandal. There were no consequences for it. How many more Cambridge Analyticas are there out there, by the way? Just harvesting all of our data for this purpose. Israel's efforts extend beyond Pascal. A group called Show Faith by Works filed documents with plans to send pro-Israel messages specifically to megachurch attendees and Christian college students, saying it could reach some 4 million of them in the Southwest through a geofencing campaign. I have no idea what that means. The group created last July said the work would involve positive associations with the nation of Israel while linking the Palestinian population with extremist factions and would cost more than $3 million. It said it planned to reach out to influential people as part of its effort and named actor Chris Pratt and basketball star Stephen Curry as two examples of ideal celebrity spokespeople. A Pratt representative said he was never contacted. A representative for Curry didn't respond, which I don't like to hear, because doesn't Curry have some involvement with an Israeli tech company?
I don't know the details off that. I think Kevin Durant I knew did, but possibly.
No, here it is.
But Curry does have a weird Hebrew tattoo that also shows like some kind of fidelity to or interest in Israel.
The Nation from March 2026. Why is Steph Curry investing in Israeli security tech?
Right.
Okay. So that's concerning to me, especially because, look, I like Steph Curry, but he also was involved in opposing a public housing development in his community.
That's right. I forgot about
the Nation.
So maybe
been...
I don't like him that much anymore. Yeah.
The Warriors
is pretty bad.
There's some problems with the Golden State Warriors. I say that as somebody who enjoyed like their, you know,
their run.
Finals against the Celtics or whatever. But
that's the one you liked?
I like that they had the cherry on top. I do. But when I think about stuff like this, this is from Dave Zirin from The Nation, on Draymond Green's Friends of IDF trip to Israel, and there's Draymond.
Oh, my God.
He would.
What is it? What is he shooting? What do you shoot? What are you putting? What do you? What's inside that scope, Draymond?
Shooting haters.
Like, and I think
the only thing he can shoot.
Part of this is like, you know, if I'm going to be generous to our friends at the Golden State Warriors on the basketball team, this is like who's owning the team and who they're associated with as they try to make investments and stuff like that. Like Draymond also, I remember he had Andre Iguodala on there talking about cryptocurrency. It's like,
but sometimes I'm more sympathetic when those things happen, when it's like a kid that's 19 or 20 who maybe, you know, didn't have, say,
than a 35-year-old vet.
Yeah, a father who was like in the NBA, right?
Yeah,
I mean, like they have every educational advantage to know that this is messed up.
Yeah.
Or at least Curry does. The Curry brothers is who I'm referring to there. But anyway, that is just, I think, the tip of the iceberg as to what we're seeing in a variety of different ways. But we showed this earlier, how there have been these identical posts about Haley Stevens growing on people. And then, you know, noun, verb, APAC, all these accounts that pretend like they were open to Abdullah Syed in general before, but hated him. They're like, huh, Haley Stevens is growing on me. No shit. You always were in the Haley Stevens faction. But they're... The amount of astroturfing this election cycle is unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, Elon buying Twitter and opening it up to bots is a big part of it, but
these aren't bots.
They're not. These people.
These are
not
real
bots.
People. They're just you know, political.
Right. Authentic. 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 They got their talking points. Authentic. Authentic.
Meghan McCain said it.
Authentic. Which Meghan McCain, who's been doing Israeli apologia all over her podcast, I would guess that this is coming from some Israeli cutout, right?
Yeah, she's also got balls of steel for standing by Israel in this environment is in the authentic tweet.
Exactly, right. That's so. Thank you for those authentic thoughts. And Meghan McCain's really growing on me right now.
I'll just say, as far as how much money Zionists will spend. Little parable. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Spend it all. You're fucked. It's over.
I'm sorry. I just didn't know where the hell you were going with Humpty Dumpty.
I guess anime is too mature for me.
Don't get me started on Mother Goose.
That's for teenagers. I like pre-K literature.
Sometimes you do got to dumb it down.
Well, with all of that said, here is Jake Tapper, who's totally, you know, ideologically independent, asking Abdul...
Really frowning over the corpse of Humpty Dumpty.
Well, he's upset that in this clip that Abdul al-Sayed said that some people might be upset after Trump assassinated the head of state in Iran. And listen to how much editorializing and how leading this question is from Jake Tapper on the so-called objective mainstream news.
20 weeks ago, when Iran's supreme leader was killed, you told your staff, according to audio obtained by the Washington Free Beacon, quote, there are a lot of people in Dearborn
Pause
who
it.
Are sad today. So
the
like, just
Washington Free Beacon is a right-wing rag. I had forgotten that that was the outlet that had basically someone recorded him saying that we should basically be sensitive after Trump launched this illegal criminal war on Iran. We should be sensitive to some in our constituency that may be sad about this. God forbid. Anyway, he said this privately as a method of campaign strategy. Do you think that they've probably also said the exact same stuff about criticism of the Israeli government, where it's like, we have Jewish constituents, we don't want to offend them in this way. Like, how do we message about this? It's just, it's ridiculous, but keep going.
On Khamenei at all, unquote. I thought that quote was interesting.
Might go back a little.
Because staff, according to audio obtained by the Washington Free Beacon, quote, there are a lot of people in Dearborn who are sad today, so like, I just don't want to comment on Khamenei at all, unquote. I thought that quote was interesting because the Ayatollah has killed tens of thousands of innocent Iranians, not to mention the proxies that Iran has funded that have killed innocent civilians all over the Middle East. Why were you worried about offending people who support the Ayatollah?
Jake, on a day where we're mourning the loss of two more service members in a war we never should have fought, I think all of us ought to step back and ask whether or not everybody in Michigan, frankly, everybody in America, shouldn't be sad about the fact that this president, backed by the prime minister of a foreign government, took us to a war we had no business fighting in. So yeah, I didn't want to comment on it then because it's a ridiculous pretext. And now you're asking me about the Ayatollah, who's dead, by the way, and you're not asking me about the service members who've died. You're not asking me about whether or not this war should have ever been fought. You're not asking me about whether or not the costs that are being borne by Michiganders in the tax dollars we pay or the gas prices that are insane right now are worth it. And so, look, let's have a conversation based in Michigan. I'm running for Senate in Michigan. And I think here in Michigan, all of us are probably sad about the fact that we went to war that we never should have fought. I'd rather our money be spent here.
I was specifically asking you about comments you didn't want to make because you didn't want to offend people in Dearborn, which is in Michigan.
Yeah. Are you aware? I mean, God, the condescension. Tapper pretends to care about killing civilians and is the biggest Zionist in the world. This is just racism.
Tapper wanted him to celebrate the decapitation strike of a foreign head of state because Jake Tapper, his Zionist ideology, wants that head of state gone. Like, Netanyahu, Joe Biden, responsible for a lot of deaths, putting a lot of military munitions in the air, missiles in the air, killed a lot of people. If they got, like, say Trump assassinated, like, the celebration of that violent act isn't really, like, appropriate either.
Right.
Like, yeah, we don't support a missile strike on a compound. By the way, this other things happened that day. And also, like, I mean, this is just fanatic. Jake Tapper and these Zionists are fanatics.
They absolutely are. And they pretend, what's amazing is they'll pretend like Abdul al-Sayed is the one that, and we could take Matt's camera down too, pretend like Abdul al-Sayed and the left are the ones that are fixated on Israel. But he flips the question and in the right way in the way that he responds. I'm focused on Michigan. what I really like what he's done is that he has reclaimed the America First thing from the right. This has been Abdul's, like...
Zoran did that too during the campaign. Why are you asking me if I'm going to take a fucking trip to Israel?
But I think it's even more pronounced with Abdul's campaign. And, you know, showing that I'm about serving people here. I want to reinvest. He's also, at some of his rallies, said it's all, you know, a lot of foreign aid for Egypt, where my family is from. And so it's a question of resources and priorities, and making that and foregrounding that, I think, is beneficial. Now, we'll see. This race, it's hard to tell. There have been some bad polling that has come out for Abdul al-Sayed, showing how he's really fallen behind in with black voters in some parts of the state. I don't know how much to believe, because there was also a poll that just came out today showing that he's doing really well. So we don't know. And this is just like a, you know, before August 4th, this is all hands on deck. If you're in Michigan, canvas, 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 support this campaign. AIPAC is banking on now this campaign being, and this primary being, an example setting exercise for anybody that chooses to support cutting aid to Israel. And they're going all hands on deck, because a Senate seat like this is immensely important. And I also think that, given their racism, they are threatened by the idea of a Muslim man also saying this incredibly forcefully in a state like Michigan. So this is the key race coming up. Although, of course, we have Cori Bush, we have Harsel Gray, we have McKinney.
This is the Senate.
Well, I mean, but this is the Senate. This is the Senate. Then this is immensely important.
Shout out Liz Warren, endorsed Abdul al-Sayed today as well.
I mean, God.
Thanks for that.
Morrow apparently, you know, worked on her campaign, so that was what that endorsement was about.
Nice if Morrow would say something. I mean, not that it could help with where Abdul al-Sayed needs help. But.
Right. Well, she's not. You think she has 0% with black voters. But
rally,
I mean,
for Stevens,
and I'm sorry. All right. Here's my last point on this. Obama is basically soft endorsing Haley Stevens by refusing to disavow the cynical, disgusting usage of his past endorsement of her in a different race in ads that are run by AIPAC all across the state, making it seem like Obama is endorsing Haley Stevens. Like, I just hope right now that the information economy is so, like, mistrusted, or that ads like that, and people have such an understanding of how corrupt they are, that it's so mistrusted that they actually look up the facts here. But this is the kind of cynical politics that wants you to be disempowered and misinformed. And it's a real shame that Obama hasn't distanced himself from it.
It's pathetic. In terms of the politics that I care about, seems kind of malicious.
Yep. All right, guys, gonna read some IMs, and then we will get out of here. Ad hominem. I was sad that day, not because the Ayatollah was killed, but because I knew it meant thousands of innocent people were about to die.
Yeah, like, nobody cares about the Ayatollah, Jake. Yeah. Who gives a flying fuck?
Yeah.
Israel?
For all the anime lovers out there, Hickory Dickory Dock.
Exactly.
Jester vaxing. Matt, what do you think of the Itsy Bitsy Spider? I thought it was a little problematic when they went back up the spout after everything they went through, but I don't know.
I mean, it's just sort of a retelling of Sisyphus.
What happened to growth? It could have been a tale of personal triumph over adversity, and yet they went back up the spout like nothing happened.
Right. Well, that's more about you right now, not learning your lessons.
Shut up.
Down came the rain and washed the spider out.
No.
Out came the sun. And... Oh, another cat.
The sun is the Grand Platinum Revelations. Yeah, back up the spout I go. Also, I'm sorry, but Liz Warren endorsements, I'm a Warren defender, and is one of the only, like, actually effective progressive politicians on a federal level in my lifetime. I don't think her endorsement means anything in
you
Michigan. Like, literally nothing.
Black Detroit is hanging on Liz Warren's
words. We were just waiting on what Liz Warren had to say.
I mean, she's big in the barbershop, I remember, from her campaign.
Look,
The brightly colored blazer Remember community the loves her.
Wait, what were you saying, Matt?
The Liz Warren barbershop.
No, I don't remember that. I blocked that out of my memory.
Okay, well, after the show.
Yeah, I'm sure. In the spirit of... Now, you know, we talked about Michael. Michael used to really rip into me about the Warren stuff. So, in the spirit of Michael, we should find that.
In honor of Michael, you should get Liz's haircut.
That would be really bad for the show, okay? I cannot pull a bowl cut off. I cannot do it. We would lose so many subscribers. Josh in California, do you think Americans can be made to understand that the Democratic Party is largely a center-right party, that they are unhappy with how things have been going, that we haven't had a leftist element to our politics in a long time?
I think they kind of get that.
Yeah.
I think that's why you see, like, progressive, like, New Deal type of politics gaining traction.
Yep. All right, five more, and then we'll get out of here. Jen from Tucson.
Generally speaking, I think voters, like, know something.
Yeah. Troy Jackson seems to be who we all wish Plattner had been, a man who had some conservative ideas on social issues combined with a more progressive economic ideology, who over time expanded his solidarity to include more marginalized identities and specifically the barriers they face. Yes. Ruben Sheep's Clothing says, Emma, if we have age verification in classrooms, then we would have to address why we have super seniors and whether children were left behind. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Rory in Minnesota, geofencing is a marketing term. Basically means you can select a certain area and certain demographics to put out ads as opposed to their online activity. Got it. Lefty band teacher, the Hasbara bots are always fun to grill. They told me that Israel shares values with the USA, like democracy, law and order, and the free press. I asked if they support democracy, why not the democratic rights of Palestinians? If they support law and order, why doesn't Israel respect the ICC or ICJ? If they support free press, why has Israel killed so many journalists? Why, while the Hasbara bots often respond, they have no response to any of that, of course. And the final IM of the day... Science is political. Tim Miller, that ex-Bush comms guy, said on that same post when he got called out for it, he said, I'm on vacation. I never got paid to go go touch grass. People shouldn't read a publication that likes Jared Polis. yeah, I'm not saying that he got paid. That's how I wanted to specify. But I mean, it would be shocking if he wasn't on some sort of email blast that would make him say something very similar on social media that maybe people who are getting paid are saying.
Yeah, no, like, just search your inbox for growing on me and see if anything comes up.
Yeah. All right, guys. Appreciate you all. Thank you so much. We will see you tomorrow. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm